Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! There will be brief intermissions of dead air so that you don't have to hear me sneezing at you. I guess we're back to normal. Yeah, some sort of something or another got me running my nose around like a sugar tree and sneezing my fool head off. That's what we say when we're sneezing down around here. We're sneezing our fool head off. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. Conversation unlike any other. Conversation radio, in fact. And welcome. Welcome to this Wednesday broadcast. How did it get to be Wednesday so darn quick? I got no idea. I did just finish reading a book in which it was asserted that time slows down in Walmart, but I'm really not willing to go in there long enough to find out. In the midst of not feeling so good and everything, I have availed myself of the works of Tim Dorsey. Yeah, he's a Florida author, and his books, beginning with Florida Roadkill and on down through Triggerfish Twist and Hammerhead Ranch Motel, and, well, it's like what would happen if the Hardy Boys grew up and one of them turned into a psychopath, let's put it that way. And they've been great entertainment and comfort to me, so a free plug out there for Tim Dorsey and his Surge A. Storms series of pulp fiction novels. Although I guess it's not pulp when it's electronic anymore. Who cares? You didn't tune in for that. At any rate, we are at the halfway mark of the first week of October, and there is an abundance of stuff to go into this evening. But of course, as you well know, Wednesdays are so much more than the middle of the week. There's so much more than hump day, so much more than downhill to Friday. Yes, indeed, brethren and sistren, Wednesdays are indeed prayer meeting Wednesdays on the Horn. Hallelujah, glory. And that's what this is. And so, as the deacons begin to pass the plate amongst the congregation, and you notice that little PayPal button down in the middle of the plate, press it if you can. Remember, we still got a challenge out there from Susan trying to match her promise of $50. And they are 50 badly needed bucks. We still got a challenge out there. Use that PayPal button, and if you want to, go to headonradionetwork.com, and the snail mail address is there for those of you who don't like to use the dreaded PayPal. But brethren and sisters, as the plate goes around, we will begin the offertory hymn. If our minister of music will please come forward. Hallelujah. No, that's the Moran. There we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
A date. And it's kind of funny because, you know, he doesn't really have any control over being asked to be the vice president. But, you know, they're putting him out there. He was at a Washington Ideas Forum where he was asked if he would turn down the VP gig if it were offered. And he said, yeah, I believe so. I'm not going to be the vice presidential nominee. The answer is going to be probably no. Probably no. Then he corrected himself. He said the answer is going to be no. So the drama now begins, and now we can have this whole drama thing. Because we've got evidently nothing else to talk about in the news media. And heaven forbid, if you look at what's going on in the news, They are doing everything they can do to demean, demoralize, and destroy what's going on in New York and what's going on in over 200 cities across this country with this occupation movement. Right here in Harrisburg tonight, in fact, I think they're still having the meeting, the Occupy Harrisburg. And we were there for about an hour, and to be honest, I was surprised by what I found. Amazing diversity. People from every walk of life, people from every race, sex, sexual orientation, I'm sure religion, age, the whole nine yards, just people from all, about 250 people showed up. And you know what they all had in common, all those people in that room? They're ticked off. They're angry. And you know, the anger showed. They're frustrated, and the frustration showed. And one of the things that they said they liked the most, they had an opportunity to be heard. So you had people standing up and for the first time in their lives saying, you know, this is how I feel, and someone's listening. I think that's hugely important, that people start to think that, you know what, we can, through all of us, enact change. We can affect change on our government. You know, for too long, the right's been telling us, well, it's the evil government. And right now, you know, you can make an argument for that. It's bought and paid for. Wall Street is running the show. The big banksters are running the show. The big billionaire trade hedge fund guys, the big billionaire entrepreneurs, they're running the show, man. Did I mention anger and frustration? Because there's a lot of that. You know, there are people who... You know, they did everything that they were told. And I go back to the beginning of the Tea Party thing, where I was hopeful that, you know what, maybe this was the moment that all of us would draw together. There was a brief second before the Tea Party thing got co-opted by the billionaire class, where people were just saying, I'm ticked. My 401k is half. The job that I was expecting to retire from is gone. The house that I put all of my blood, sweat, and tears in is now the value of it is collapsing. And for a lot of people, I'm underwater in my mortgage. I owe more than it's worth. So everything I was told all along, you know, kind of backfiring. And they were angry and they were frustrated. What I'm hoping that this doesn't happen to this movement, to this occupation movement, what I'm hoping doesn't happen is that the big money people come in and co-op it. And I don't think that the folks will let that. The people that I met tonight, I really don't believe that they would let that happen. Because this is an opportunity to be heard. This is an opportunity to bring people together. And even if you don't agree 100%, there are some things I think we are universal. And you look at the fact that I think everyone, virtually everyone, could point to Wall Street and say, you did this. You and the big bankers, the speculators, you did this. You created this mess that we've suffered under for going on for 3 years now. September of 2008, the collapse happened. And here we are, 3 years later, still digging out of it. And you got people like Herman Cain saying, oh, gee, you know, if you don't have a job, it's your own fault. Blame yourself. Don't blame Wall Street. Blame yourself. Well, you know, Wall Street back in 2008, you know, they may have been responsible back then, but they're not anymore. Really? They put us in a massive ditch. They dug a bottomless ditch, and we're just trying to get back out of it. You stop and think about all the wealth that has been stolen from the American middle class. You stop and think of all the opportunity that's been stolen from American students. You stop and think about all the opportunity that's now gone because these greedy you-know-whats, they line their pockets. It was never going to be enough. And for me, the one thing that has to happen, the universal thing that I think I'm hoping that this movement can accomplish, is for them to force Congress to go back and repeal Gramm-Leach-Bliley, reinstate Glass-Steagall, separate the banking. In fact, break up the banks. Make them smaller local banks. That, well, if one does the dumb thing and fails, you let them fail. Too big to fail was bad in 2008. Too big to fail now is worse. because we've allowed those banks to consolidate. We've allowed more of this to happen. And I blame the president. I blame Congress. There's an awful lot of blame to go around. And did Dodd-Frank take us closer? Dodd-Frank was a gesture, but it wasn't Glass-Steagall. It wasn't undoing all of the damage that happened in 1999 when we passed this through, when we allowed this to pass. And it passed without most people even knowing it was going on. I remember Phil Graham, Tippy Turtle. I remember him saying, oh, this is going to be the greatest thing in the world. A former bank guy himself. Greatest thing in the world. It's going to help our economy. We're going to grow by leaps and bounds. And it did for the very, very wealthy. They did really, really well. You and I, we got screwed. And now we're left holding this big bag of steaming you-know-what. And they want to place blame somewhere else. There are an awful lot of things we should be doing. Getting money out of politics, one. Very good. Very first step for me. Transaction tax on Wall Street, another very good step. But as this occupation thing goes forward, we're hoping the folks here in Harrisburg grow this. I think this is going to be exciting stuff. We're going to be on the front lines of this, bringing it to you every night. Tomorrow we're going to Philadelphia to be part of the startup of Occupy Philadelphia. So that should be really exciting. We're going to record tomorrow, play tomorrow night. So look forward to that. And look, I understand why people are upset. I mean, how can you not be? Ben Bernanke even can see why people are upset, which is, you know, kind of amazing considering the perch that he sits on. And what I think is important is that this whole occupation movement is not a Republican or Democratic thing, has nothing to do with that. It's really not a political party thing. It's a, hey, we're ticked off. I'm pissed, and let's do something about it. Let's get out in the streets and make some noise, because that's how things evidently have to be done in this country. The only time that the wealth class cedes any control is when it looks like there's someone storming the gate. So, yeah, it's not a political thing. I mean, you look today, for instance. You want something that's going to tick me off about Democrats? Today, I'm pretty ticked off at my Democratic friends. The congressional committee in charge of passing through these three free trade agreements with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama, well, they just pushed it right on through. In fact, the Colombia vote was 24-12. The House and Senate committee, yeah, just pushed that right on through. 24-12. Panama got passed 31-3. South Korea, 31-5. So we're gonna pass through a free trade agreement with a country that throws union members out of planes, that shoots union leaders in the head. And we're going to pass an agreement with the Panamanians where we can have our billionaire class go and park their money. Sounds like a great idea, doesn't it? Just insanity. But, you know, this is why I'm excited that this movement this could be the beginning of activating and educating the electorate. And that's what the billionaire class has got to be scared to death over. People were actually talking about issues. That's something. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around. We're right back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Inspired by both the Arab Spring and the Madison, Wisconsin worker uprising, progressive activists in 100 or more cities coast to coast are occupying city squares and plazas to protest corporate domination. The Occupy Wall Street action continues to grow in the wake of hundreds of arrests for civil disobedience. On Thursday, the Occupy movement comes to the nation's capital. These uprisings are an effort to bring real democracy to America and end corporate control of our economy, political system, and public policies. Maria Allwine is a Baltimore activist working on the Occupy DC action that begins Thursday in Freedom Plaza there.
You see the assault on labor. We're back in the 20s and the 30s when labor was trying to get a foothold. People are so angry, and they finally get that we have to wrest control back to ourselves. We're going to have people's assemblies every day, the general assemblies at night. We have civil resistance actions. We have all kinds of things planned.
While the Occupy movement protesters have many issues, there is a single overarching focus common to everyone joining this movement.
The overarching issue is the role that corporations play in determining our lives. They have a stranglehold on government, no longer serves us, serves the corporate interest, and we are determined that that is not the kind of country that we're going to live in.
On Tuesday, the Occupy Wall Street movement received one of its largest endorsements when the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees pledged to stand in solidarity. Jesse Russell has more on that.
President Gerald McEntee and Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders compared what's happening on Wall Street to the winter protests in Madison, Wisconsin. They said the message to Wall Street is clear. Priority number one should be rebuilding Main Street, not fueling the power of corporate CEOs and their marionette politicians. That endorsement came on the same day as the 700,000 member-strong Communication Workers of America expressing their support. The message from the CWA comes at a time when Verizon workers could soon find themselves back on the strike lines. Also levying support on Tuesday was the Amalgamated Transit Union. They've promised support both physically in the protests, but also by providing food and other supplies.
The UAW and Ford Motor have reached a tentative deal on a new four-year contract. The union says it means 12,000 jobs created or retained as Ford invests $16 billion in the North American auto industry. More details will be released as the UAW's 41,000 Ford members vote on the proposed new contract. On Tuesday, working people took a message to politicians on Capitol Hill. Pass President Obama's American Jobs Act and don't pass more global trade deals that kill U.S. jobs. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard and International Association of Machinists President Tom Buffenbarger were among those pushing Congress to act on jobs and to reject pending trade deals they say won't create jobs or help working people. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So this week marks the 50th anniversary of the Pennsylvania Prevailing Wage Act. And you know what I love to hear? I love to hear Republicans saying, oh, well, conservatives believe in institution. Conservatives believe in, you know, honoring the past and our history. The folks that we've got running the Republican Party today, they don't believe any of that. They're looking for radical change, undoing 50 years, the last 50 years of our history. Is that what you voted for? I don't think so. That's why I've asked our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, to come on and talk to us a little bit about this. 50 years, Irwin, and they want to throw it out the window.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe they want to, while they're doing it, because anything that's that old, you know, only 10 years younger than me, anything that's that old probably ought to be destroyed. So maybe anybody that's over 50 years of age ought to be destroyed with them. And that silly thing, the Constitution, you know, that was adopted in 1789, so here we are 230 some years later, maybe we got to do away with that. And oh, by the way, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that's the oldest Supreme Court operating in the United States. It predates the Revolution. We certainly ought to abolish that, because it's really old if a 50-year-old prevailing wage law that has served the test of time is too old. So makes perfect sense to me.
No. But here's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of folks who I don't think really understand what the prevailing wage is supposed to do, what its goal is, and what it actually does for society, what it actually does for working people across this state.
Well, it really doesn't do a whole lot for working people other than assure that they get at least as a minimum wage the rates that prevail, that are most frequently paid, in their communities for the work they perform on taxpayer-funded jobs. But what it really does, and this is quite significant and has done since day one, 50 years ago, is protect taxpayers from using tax dollars to fund a race to the bottom and protect legitimate Pennsylvania businesses from unfair competition by construction contractors who would come from outside of Pennsylvania, maybe even overseas now, and exploit taxpayers by paying low wages, but not giving the taxpayers a break on the price. The reality is that despite all these protestations to the contrary from the jingoistic drumbeat of let's do something to the prevailing wage law because it's 50 years old, the Prevailing Wage Act is one of those visionary pieces of legislation adopted by a General Assembly, sponsored, by the way, initially not by Democrats but by Republicans. It was aimed at protecting the economy, protecting taxpayers, and it has done a fantastic, beautiful, just enviable job. And therefore, of course, you must tear it apart, tear it down, and decimate it.
So let me ask you this. You know, I keep hearing folks like the guy over at the little tinky tank of the Commonwealth Foundation saying, oh, we could save 30% on building costs. That school would be 30% less. All we have to do is get rid of this little pesky thing.
Well, what he ought to really do, instead of offering up silly opinions on the laws of Pennsylvania, whether it happens to be the prevailing wage law, on which he's obviously an expert, or the next day on education law, on which he's obviously an expert, or the day after that on health care issues, on which he is obviously an expert, or the day after that on transportation, another series of things on which he is obviously an expert. What he ought to do, if he believes this poison, is to start to find how he can sell whatever it is he consumes, because obviously has an impact that is mind-altering. Let me tell you, Rick, that in order to save 30% on the cost of a school, the cost of labor alone on a school construction project would have to be 70 to 80% of the total cost. And we know, beyond peradventure, that the largest costs involved in public construction and private construction are construction materials. The second largest costs are architectural and engineering activities. Labor is way down on the list. But let's assume that labor is 30% of the total cost of a job. In order to save the 30% of which that guy speaks, everybody would have to work for free. Okay? And intriguingly, in all of the proposals that are out there to manipulate, decimate, devastate, and destroy the Pennsylvania Prevailing Wage Act, every single one of them stands for the proposition of using the General Assembly and the laws of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to cut people's wages, but not one of them, not one of the six bills has a paragraph, a section, a sentence, a phrase, or even a word that requires one penny of the money that is taken out of the pockets of workers on those jobs to make their way back to the taxpayers. All this is doing is reallocating where the money that will inevitably be spent goes away from workers into the hands of the exploiting corporate structures that are wrongfully and unfairly competing with legitimate Pennsylvania businesses whose rights are really the object of the protection offered by the Pennsylvania Prevailing Wage.
So if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is he's telling us 30% savings on construction costs, yet there's nothing in any of the language that provides for that. There's no guarantee. There's no way of measuring that even.
Well, there's nothing in the legislative proposals that are out there that require one penny of savings, much less 30%. And the only way you could get to 30% would be if everybody worked for nothing, because the reality is construction materials have a cost, and a bigger company maybe pays a few pennies less than a smaller company because of volume, but construction materials are what they are. Architects are out there, and they get paid on the basis of percentage of construction costs. Engineers, same thing. Okay, if somebody really wanted to save money on a school building, the state would do us all a favor by designing plans for a large elementary school, a medium elementary school, and a small elementary school, and a large high school, and a medium-sized high school, and a small high school. And instead of every time some school district wants to build or revamp a school building, that they go out and hire an architect who draws designs and imposes, if you will, a Taj Mahal in the name of the memory of the latest superintendent of schools or the latest school board president, that we have those plans in the hopper, and every school district doesn't have to reinvent the wheel and expend the 5 to 10% of the cost of construction that is imposed by every architect on every public project every single time.
Well, they've got better lobbyists.
It's not that they have better lobbyists. It's just that we live in an economy and in a political era when somehow or another a group of very vocal politicians think that it's appropriate, safe, and in pursuit of the public interest to kick working people, you know, the ones who actually pay taxes, unlike the corporations, the ones who actually give a fair day's work for a fair day's wage and give a fair and better than fair day's work for less than a fair day's wage these days. But what's most offensive is that what we are hearing with little response, whether it's from the tinky-tanky guy that you refer to or the multiplicity of state House members and state senators who keep on banging the drum, is that they want to use our public legislative process, our taxpayer-funded legislative process, to cut people's wages at a time when we're trying to bring the economy back up. And it's as if people who work at these jobs don't spend virtually every cent they earn, okay? And every time they spend money, they're priming the pump of our economy, putting more people to work, unlike the people on the other side of the equation who are holding on to their money, we've all learned about that, even when they don't pay any taxes, and stuffing it in the bank or stuffing it under the mattress instead of putting it back into the economy, allowing more things to happen, more goods and services to be sold, and therefore putting people back to work.
Which brings me to the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, you know, what's going on in New York. In Philadelphia tomorrow, we're going to be at the Occupy Philadelphia here in Harrisburg. This evening, there was a meeting on, you know, how to start an Occupy Harrisburg. You're seeing people who are coming out of the woodworks finally, something I've been calling for the longest time, saying, you know, we're ticked off. The jobs aren't there. The education that I got, there's no job for me at the end. I'm saddled with these huge loans. And Wall Street, these big businesses, and these wealthy folks doing really well at our expense.
Well, we have the ongoing building of a grassroots movement in America. It started in Wisconsin. It spread rapidly from Wisconsin to Indiana to Kentucky, up in Maine. And now it's like lightning across the country. And unlike the phony baloney teabaggers who are really just a front group for a bunch of, you know, big agri, big corporation, big financial, big insurance, big pharma, big healthcare insurers. These are really grassroots people coming together. And this is basically what I envision as the counter to the so-called Tea Party. This is the People's Party. And it's taken off, and now, amazingly enough, the traditional news media, other than the Rick Smith Show, are giving it attention, recognizing that this is not something that is a pass-through. This is much, much more than that. And we see the police under the corporate, you know, leadership in New York of Bloomberg, you know, Bloomberg TV, Bloomberg Financial, Bloomberg Mayor.
Bloomberg News, absolutely.
Bloomberg News. All of a sudden, under Bloomberg, the New York City cops were arresting people on the Brooklyn Bridge over the weekend. And now the cops are looking at this and saying, hey, there's only a hair's breadth between what those people are talking about and what's happening to us. And we got the cops marching, and we got veterans marching. I saw a sign this morning, a veteran holding a sign saying that I fought in two wars, one over there and one here. At least this time I know who my enemy is.
Excellent point. And I mean, and do you think that's becoming clear? Because all I keep hearing from the corporate-controlled for-profit media is that, well, you know, they don't have any demands. We don't know why they're out there. Trump was out there. Oh, we don't know why we're out there. The whole bunch of them.
Well, I think, candidly, what you just articulated is among the truest statements I've seen in my life. I don't think any of these corporate cavaliers know why our folks are out there. But you know what? The people involved and the people seeing it do know. And these jerks are all out there waiting to hear what somebody's demands are. Well, we as a people have only one demand, and that is that we have a voice in our governance and in our government, that we have a chance to speak because the one great equalizer in a democracy is our right to vote. And they may be able to outspend us, and they certainly have outmaneuvered us, and it may be that they have the capacity to outmanipulate us. But there are more of us than there are of them, and that continues to be the case. And if they want to know what it is we want our government back, and if they are curious or don't get it, we'll teach them. We'll teach them this November, and we'll teach them even better next November.
Now, you know, I was at the Occupy Harrisburg meeting this evening, and a lot of issues kept coming up. Wall Street, the Citizens United. We could go on for a whole day, but one of the things that kept popping up was the drilling tax. The fact that, because they're still deciding whether they want to focus only on national issues or state issues. People kept saying, it's just not right that we're not taxing the drillers. They're taking this commodity out from under our feet, and we've got a governor who's hell-bent on not taxing them, signed his little pledge, and now some halfway impact fee. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, when is a tax not a tax? I guess it's when Grover Norquist tells Tom Corbett that this extraction fee is not a tax, and as long as it is below market value and it doesn't do anything to anticipatorily deal with the strafing that's going on in north central and northwest Pennsylvania as a result of the Marcellus shale industry, I guess then it's not really a tax. But we all know what it is, and we all know that it's a day late and dollar short, way too little, and it's a joke. But in the last analysis, Tom Corbett does get one aspect of this right. It really is a national issue, because while they're extracting this gas from under the ground of Pennsylvania and destroying an environment and a water supply, not to mention streets, roads, highways, and communities, we're not getting the gas. The gas is going elsewhere. The gas is being sold overseas. The gas is doing the same old thing, and people are confused about why we're marching on Wall Street, why we're marching on Philadelphia, why we're occupying Boston, why we're occupying Harrisburg. Need not spend a whole lot of time being confused. They need to spend a little bit of time understanding that there's only so much you can do to us before we strike back.
Yeah, there's only so much of it that you'll eat, mm-hmm. And eventually you get tired of it.
Yeah, well, eventually, once you get past the smell, you get to the taste. Okay.
Excellent point. And that's why I think this is exciting, and I hope to see when this takes off, would love to see you come down and visit.
Well, listen, I'm in way beyond my waist and up above my shoulders, and I agree with you. It's a very exciting time. It's exciting when people open up, and in this environment in particular, when they have been fed so many lies and have been told to be convinced that their voices don't count, that they've been told that they need not any longer be frustrated by the system because the system has defeated them. We're taking back our system. We have a voice. We have a vote. And in the end, what will come inevitably of this, because political people who stand for election are, if nothing else, opportunistic, is a recognition that if they want to stay in office, they're going to change the way they do business. And if they don't change the way they do business, they're not going to stay in office.
That's exactly. That's the hope. Right there is the hope. Irwin, always great talking to you. I appreciate the time. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Talk to you next week. Be well, be safe, be careful, stay out of trouble, and let's march.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Listening at last to his inner FDR, President Obama is going straight at the know-nothing, do-nothing Republican Congress. At a recent rally on a bridge connecting Representative John Boehner's state of Ohio to Senator Mitch McConnell's state of Kentucky, Obama challenged the two GOP leaders to back his plan for repairing and improving our country's deteriorating infrastructure. "Help us rebuild this bridge," he shouted out to Boehner and McConnell. "Help us rebuild America. Help us put this country back to work." "Yes, let's do it." However, in addition to the usual recalcitrance of reactionary Republican leaders, another impediment stands in the way of success. Many of the infrastructure jobs that would be created could end up in China. Holy Uncle Sam! How is this possible? It's due to a trap door that was built into the 1933 Buy American Act. This law gives preference to U.S. companies bidding on major infrastructure projects, except it allows the general contractor to opt out of this requirement if the difference in U.S. and foreign bids is significant. This is no theoretical concern, for it's already happening. For example, the $7 billion reconstruction of the Bay Bridge between San Francisco and Oakland is in the hands of a state-subsidized Chinese company that made the lowest bid. While there are Americans involved in this huge project, the design, engineering, prefab, supervision, and other work, as well as profits, are going to China. Consequently, California's hard-hit people and depressed economy are deprived of the wages, taxes, and consumer spending they would have gotten from some 3,000 jobs that went overseas. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, let's approve Obama's infrastructure proposal, but let's improve it by nailing the opt-out trapdoor shut. For information, go to AmericanManufacturing.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time for change. Time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for
you know, that's what the folks are calling for.
You know, status quo, not going to make it anymore. I'm hoping that we're going to see tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets. This moment, one of those moments in history where you go, this is something to be a part of. And I'm hoping to see that this grows and grows until eventually we get some of the things that we all know is wrong. As I said from the beginning, to me, Glass-Steagall, a return to sanity is a smart thing. Undoing Citizens United, a good thing for our democracy. A whole lot of good stuff. You know, maybe going and, like the president said, the Buffett rule, if you will, asking those who have done wildly well. Now, I would probably ask for a lot more than the president's doing and what Democrats are asking for, but it's a start. Start looking at the things that have created this crisis that we're in. For me, one of the main things would be making it easier for folks to join and form unions. The number one way to close the gap between the CEO class and the working class. And you look at the fact that the average U.S. worker who loses his job maybe gets a week, maybe 2 weeks of severance for every year that they've been in service to the employer. Maybe a week, maybe two. In 2011. So far this year, I mean, stop, listen, this is just mind-blowing. Departed CEOs who got thrown out of their job, the five highest chief executive severance packages have averaged 724 weeks for each year of service. That's not 724 weeks, that's 724 weeks for each year of service. You want to talk about unequal? You want to talk about insanity? The way we allow these CEOs to get away with this kind of highway robbery is just mind-blowing. But again, the reason I bring up this in comparison to unions, unions have contracts. I think every worker on this planet should have a contract. What's expected of you is written out. What's expected of the employer is written out, and it's all right there in black and white. None of this, you're at my will. But we have a CEO class who, they won't take a job without a contract, which is why you end up seeing them get 724 weeks of severance for every single year. It's just amazing to me. And I think people are finally waking up. And tonight I got to be honest. I'm excited. I'm thrilled. I think this is fantastic that you're finally going to have an opportunity to come out and begin to talk about issues. You may not always agree, but in a group begin having those conversations without the billionaire class dangling carrots over our heads. I think it's pretty exciting. And you look at some new polling data out, you know, to support the Buffett rule. Nearly half of the people in a couple of these recent polls, one by the Harrison Group and one by American Express, they've come out and said, look, you know, people want folks taxed who are making $500,000 a year or more. More than half of the people want that. For people making over $1 million, you got two-thirds of the people who say, you know what, yeah, that's a good idea. Instead of taxing the people at the bottom, instead of saying, you know what, you know, those poor people, they don't pay anything, they don't have any skin in the game. Do you know why they don't have why they're not paying the federal income tax? They don't make enough money. If you take that little bit away from them, what do you end up doing? You end up, A, harming them more, end up putting them more into poverty, and slowing down the economy, because that's money that used to go directly into the communities. But never mind that. But we're seeing this push. We're seeing people going, you know what? You know, maybe we need to look at what we've allowed the very wealth class to get away with. At the minimum, and, you know, this is one of those things that I think is important. At the minimum, we should make working as rewarding as sitting on your behind collecting dividend checks. I mean, if you're going to have two separate tax rates, I would think the tax rate for someone who's out there busting their behind, that would be a little lower than the one of, just my money's making money for me. And what gets me is you talk to people and go, well, you're just engaging in class warfare. I don't think most folks get how far we've grown apart. You know, back in the 60s, you could see the CEO of the company at a decent restaurant. You could possibly be on the same airline. You could possibly be in the same world. Not anymore. We live in completely different worlds. When John Edwards talked about the two Americas, this is what he was talking about. The very, very wealthy, the top 1%, that upper echelon, and then the rest of us, the two Americas. You know, you go to a football game. Do you think you're going to sit next to a CEO there, unless you're in New York? Do you think you're going to sit next to the CEO at the ball game? No, they're up in those skyboxes. They're separate. They've got separate entrances. They've got separate parking lots. They don't want to sit next to you because they're better than us. And the top 1% of this country owns 40% of the nation's wealth. They don't have to be around us because they own us. And you stop and think about it. The bottom 80% of us own only 7% of the nation's wealth. That is just mind-blowing to me. That 80% of the nation has only 7% of the wealth of this nation. Think about that. Now, you go back just 25 years. And Joseph Stiglitz has written extensively on this. You know, back 25 years ago, they only owned 33%. Where are we going to be in 25 more years? Will they be up to 50%? Will it be up to 60%? Will they own it all? How much is enough? And we keep hearing this, oh, wow, you know, I'm so sick of the stock market horse race. I'm so tired of this. Every day, stocks up, stocks down, and the whole country pays attention to this. Because, oh, I've got a 401k, or, oh, I got a stock. The top 1% owns half of this nation's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The top 1%. You know how much the bottom half of us, you know how much the bottom 50% of us hold? You know how many of these investments, how much stock, how many bonds, how many mutual funds the bottom half of us own, the 150-some million people? 0.5%. A half a percent. And yet they tell us, oh, well, you know, the stock market's important for everybody. No, the stock market's important for the wealth class. Now, they've really gotten us, and they've done a masterful job with this whole 401k crap. They've done a great job buying us into, oh, we got to worry about Wall Street because we've got a small stake in the game. And to us, you know, the money that I've got in my 401k, and I like everybody else, I've got one too. I look at that statement, I go, oh, I lost, you know, $2,000 or I lost $5,000, and that's a lot for me. And they get you thinking that way. Oh, we got to do what's in the best interest of the shareholders because we're all shareholders. Somehow we got to get off that treadmill. Somehow we need to get off that treadmill and start, you know what, We need to find pensions again. We need to be fighting for those things as well. But that's not the way the conversation's going to go. And we're the ones in debt, not them. I mean, we are in worse economic shape as a working class than we have been since the 20s. The gulf between the those who have and the those who don't, wider since any time since the 1920s. And how did that happen? Well, it happened because you had a Republican Party and a large number of Democrats who bought into this neoliberalism, who bought into free trade policies and open border policies for goods and services, who bought into busting unions so we can drive down wages, who bought into to not investing in education and health care and infrastructure, but to feed the very wealthy. You know, they talked about trickle down. There's no such thing as trickle down. All the wealth, obviously, as I have just pointed out, has trickled up. The only trickle down we get is that yellow stuff. A little salty. That's all we get. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts, questions, comments, something, anything on your mind, right back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers.
And of course, they're willing to rub our noses in it. As I said, there was a sort of Marie Antoinette moment in Chicago. Don't know if you saw it, but it bears paying attention to. If, and it's a big if it was not a non-violent movement, these guys would have a big problem. You see, Occupy Wall Street has expanded all over the country. It will be opening up Friday in Washington, D.C., with the October 2006 movement. You may have heard Dr. Margaret Palmer talking about it briefly last week on the program. Or maybe week before last. God, it's all run together for me now. I'm sitting here kicking myself because I'm supposed to be there. And can't. Just can't. But it is expanding, and it has expanded, in fact, to Chicago. Protesters gathered outside the Chicago Board of Trade, the world's oldest options and futures trading center, where only recently they stopped the trade in pork bellies, I believe. And And they, with their signs, we are the 99%, gathered in their protests. Some began to look upwards toward the windows of the Chicago Board of Trade, where they saw signs taped to windows along one floor. It was the eighth floor, in fact, of the building that houses the Chicago Board of Trade. And it said, we are the 1%. We are the 1%. Come out from behind your eighth floor windows and walls and say that.
That they're doing. To me, it just seems like we can't get anything accomplished for people like me. Now, these trade agreements are going to flow right through like butter. And we're going to see job losses. And in 10 years, looking back, we're going to go another Democrat jabbed us in the back. I mean, because how can you look at NAFTA and say it was anything other than a job killer? And how can anybody in this country who works for a living go, oh, yeah, more free trade for me, please? You know, it's kind of like the one comedian I like, that Eddie Izzard. Cake or death. It's like saying, yeah, give me death, please. No, I've had enough cake. I want death. Which is what these free trade agreements are. And you hear Herman Cain. You know, you got to love the Herman Cain train. Who says that he believes that the Obama administration is orchestrating the Occupy Wall Street. He's behind it. He says, you know, don't go out there blaming Wall Street. Don't blame banks. If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself. And I'm going, really? Blame yourself because there's no jobs out there? Blame yourself because the economy's in the toilet? And he goes on to say, well, you know, the banks, it could have been their problem. It was their fault back in 2008. But this isn't 2008 anymore. You're right, but we have dug a major hole. And who dug that hole? You can say it, Wall Street. That's right. Which is where I think the good amount of anger is being placed by the folks in these occupations. They're going, look, we know who screwed this up. We know who we got to go after. But what the Republicans have turned around and given us, they've said, oh, no, it wasn't the big banks. It wasn't the speculation. It wasn't the big traders, and it wasn't all the Bernard Madoffs. It wasn't them. No. Remember when those teachers, those lazy teachers and those overpaid, greedy state workers, remember when they crashed the economy? Well, no, I don't. But that's what they keep feeding us. Oh, it's those teachers. It's those government employees. They've got benefits that you don't have. Go get them. Instead of saying, hey, wait a minute, I'd like to have some of those benefits. I would like health care, thank you very much. We're being directed at going after others to steal from them. And I love this idea, oh, we're going to save government money. We're going to save money by cutting people's wages? That's going to save the country? A spiraling down effect of people who then aren't going to be paying taxes? That's the way we go? Firing more public sector workers, firing more teachers, more job loss. That's the way we're going to dig ourselves out of this mess? By digging deeper first? Is that what has to happen? Is this the China syndrome and nobody told me? We're going to dig straight through the globe to hit to the bottom? Because after all, these policies are going to lead us to the same kind of living standard that the folks in China have. Going on Greece, you got 20,000 people out in the streets in Athens. 20,000 people saying, you know what? No more layoffs, no more wage cuts, no more new taxes for us. Start going after the people who caused this mess. And at some point, and I'm hoping we're here, man, I'm hoping we're here. Because the same things that they're doing to the folks in Greece, they want to do here. They want to cut everybody's wages. They want to do away with benefits. They want to make sure that you don't have the ability to stand together anymore. And they're using the police departments to do it. I mean, you look at what's going on in New York. They're pepper spraying people. Again. What's it going to take? How long is this going to go on? I mean, does it make sense to you that the best way forward is to cut teachers' pay, is to cut the number of teachers, is the best way forward to cut the number of police and fire and state employees so that we don't get services? Is that the way? Now, if I were a Republican or I was a big, you know, right-wing conservative, that would be the answer. Because then you make government small and ineffective. Because when you hear smaller government, think ineffective. Think unable to respond to any crisis. Think the incapable of responding when we have a disaster, which is where they want us. If you stop and think of all the investment that's gone on over the generations before us in healthcare and education and in our nation, could we possibly do that today? I mean, is it possible if we could come up with the cure for cancer? Is it possible that we could build a highway system in this country like we did during the Eisenhower years? Would that be possible today? The space race, do you think we could make it to the moon today with the gridlock we have in Washington and the gridlock we have in every state house across this country? Do you think that's possible? Because I don't. Not with these people in charge. And I love this country as much as anybody, and I think great things, and I think we have unlimited potential, but we've got people holding us back. We got people holding us down. And it's these people. And next election cycle, they got to go. Anybody who voted for this free trade agreement got to go in my mind. I don't care who you are. Anybody who tells me every person in this country doesn't deserve health care, got to go. Got to go. And that's where we got to be. It doesn't matter about party to me. It matters what you're doing and how it affects me and the people who live around me and all the people who are at the Occupy Harrisburg tonight and all the people who will be in Philadelphia tomorrow. That's what it's about. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to talk with Kate Gordon, Vice President of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress. Back after this.
Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Inspired by both the Arab Spring and the Madison, Wisconsin worker uprising, progressive activists in 100 or more cities coast to coast are occupying city squares and plazas to protest corporate domination. The Occupy Wall Street action continues to grow in the wake of hundreds of arrests for civil disobedience. On Thursday, the Occupy movement comes to the nation's capital. These uprisings are an effort to bring real democracy to America and end corporate control of our economy, political system, and public policies. Maria Allwine is a Baltimore activist working on the Occupy DC action that begins Thursday in Freedom Plaza there.
You see the assault on labor. We're back in the 20s and the 30s when labor was trying to get a foothold. People are so angry, and they finally get that we have to wrest control back to ourselves. We're going to have people's assemblies every day, the general assemblies at night. We have civil resistance actions. We have all kinds of things planned.
While the Occupy movement protesters have many issues, there is a single overarching focus common to everyone joining this movement.
The overarching issue is the role that corporations play in determining our lives. They have a stranglehold on government, no longer serves us, serves the corporate interest, and we are determined that that is not the kind of country that we're going to live in.
On Tuesday, the Occupy Wall Street movement received one of its largest endorsements when the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees pledged to stand in solidarity. Jesse Russell has more on that.
President Gerald McEntee and Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders compared what's happening on Wall Street to the winter protests in Madison, Wisconsin. They said the message to Wall Street is clear. Priority number one should be rebuilding Main Street, not fueling the power of corporate CEOs and their marionette politicians. That endorsement came on the same day as the 700,000 member-strong Communication Workers of America expressing their support. The message from the CWA comes at a time when Verizon workers could soon find themselves back on the strike lines. Also levying support on Tuesday was the Amalgamated Transit Union. They've promised support both physically in the protests, but also by providing food and other supplies.
The UAW and Ford Motor have reached a tentative deal on a new four-year contract. The union says it means 12,000 jobs created or retained as Ford invests $16 billion in the North American auto industry. More details will be released as the UAW's 41,000 Ford members vote on the proposed new contract. On Tuesday, working people took a message to politicians on Capitol Hill. Pass President Obama's American Jobs Act and don't pass more global trade deals that kill U.S. jobs. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard and International Association of Machinists President Tom Buffenbarger were among those pushing Congress to act on jobs and to reject pending trade deals they say won't create jobs or help working people. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. So as I've been saying, the Republicans are you know, dancing in the streets, happy as can be, because they think with these couple of solar companies that are going down, that they can now call the end to the whole alternative energy, the green energy movement. And I've been saying, 2012 to me will be a repeat of 1980 if we don't put a stop to this. Because, you know, remember in 1980, there was a path towards, you know, getting off the juice, alternative energy. Carter did a lot of good things, and Reagan came in and undid them all. And my fear is 2012, we do this again. That's why I've asked Kate Gordon. She's the Vice President of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is the website. Kate, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, how are you?
I'm good. You know, I see the going down of Solyndra and a couple of these other companies, and the right's reaction of glee almost that, you know, we spent this money, but now we can call this all dead. I'm kind of worried.
I'm worried too. It's really just depressing that Solyndra has become kind of a poster child, not just for one loan program, but really it's being used to kind of sound the death knell of the entire set of investments in clean energy and really, you know, raise the flag of oil and gas. And I think that's really what you're seeing is the triumph of the oil and gas lobby in Washington over, you know, the public, frankly, and the rest of the business community.
So as I said, you know, to me, 2012 could be that repeat of 1980 all over again. And my fear is it'll be another 30 years before we start talking about clean energy and renewable energy again.
Well, you know, I think in Washington and in Congress, we're all very concerned about what's going to happen in 2012. But I think there are signs of hope that make it sort of different than 1980. There are businesses now that are really taking seriously the fact that resources will be extremely constrained in the next 20, 30 years. There are businesses that are taking seriously the fact that oil is a really volatile community and the commodity and the prices are very up and down. So we're seeing, you know, places like the Department of Defense make major investments in renewables. We're seeing businesses make major investments in renewables and in efficiency. I kind of think we're seeing some signs outside of Washington that this is a real thing. And, you know, what's crazy is that Washington hasn't caught up yet.
You know, I look at the Chinese, and you know, they're investing hundreds of billions of dollars into solar and wind and all of these alternative technologies, because I think – and they know, like we should know, that whoever conquers that next frontier will be the global superpower for the next century.
Well, that's right. China has really made this a priority, a national priority. Their 12th five-year plan puts renewable energy and emerging energy as one of their major pillars of economic development. So what China has done, which is very different than what we do, is they've said, look, we want to be the major producers of this stuff. We want to be the major users of this stuff. We wanted to anchor our economic growth strategy. That's why they're investing in manufacturing. They're investing in, you know, innovation. They're investing in sort of every part of the value chain of solar, wind, and all these renewable energies. And it's not just because they know that they have a resource problem with their own growing citizenship. It's because they want to be a leader. They, as you said, they want to be the global leaders. The EU is doing something similar. I mean, the EU has passed a number of kind of requirements for the European countries, saying you have to use a certain amount of renewables or a certain amount of efficiency. Every one of the European countries is having to meet those standards. They're all doing it in different ways. But as they're doing it, they're trying to become global leaders. The UK is becoming a global leader in offshore wind. Germany is becoming a global leader in wind and solar. So you're really seeing these countries take this as an economic imperative, not just an environmental imperative.
And why aren't we seeing it in the same way? I mean, is it that we're we're that in the back pocket of the gas industry?
Well, you know, you take a step back and you realize we're the only country out of every single one of these countries, developed or developing, that hasn't accepted global warming as a fundamental reality. So that was a conversation all these other countries had a long time ago. It's already part of their bottom line. So that's a big reason. but, you know, also I think that we have just made this into an enormously partisan issue, and it's just become a real talking point for the Republicans in particular to come out against clean energy as a government conspiracy. And I think that's just really short-sighted.
Absolutely. You know, and bringing up the global warming, even if you don't, let's say you, for one odd reason or another, you don't believe it.
Yeah.
Doesn't it make sense to get off of the one commodity that we get from people who hate us? Doesn't it make sense to say, well, you know what, burning fossil fuels, probably not the best to breathe. Maybe do something that's not going to kill you?
Well, you know, this is what I always say to people. It's like, okay, even if you don't believe in it, first of all, other countries do, and they have major consumer markets, so we should be trying to sell to them. Number two, even if you don't believe it, you got to believe that resources are getting constrained. We are seeing water shortages and food shortages all over the world and some places in the United States. We have to figure out a way to deal with resource constraints. And finally, you know, Americans believe in choice, and you'd think we'd believe in choice in our energy. You know, I would like to have the choice of what kind of energy I use and where it comes from, and whether it comes from oil, gas, coal, you know, natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar. I would like to have that kind of choice, or the choice not to use very much of it at all. And I feel like that's a real American value. We should be emphasizing that.
I'm right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Kate Gordon. She's Vice President of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. A second ago, you said that the Chinese have decided that they want to corner the market. They want to build it. They want to use all of this renewable energy, all of these you know, wind, solar, all of that. And what frustrates me is you look at, like, down in Texas, for instance, we were going to build a big wind farm. And where did we get the solar panels or the turbines from? China. And who actually put them up? The Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's going to happen. I mean, let's be honest. If this country doesn't take seriously the imperative to kind of move to a clean energy future, if we don't start to pass the policies and programs to ensure domestic demand for these products, we're going to have a really hard time scaling up on manufacturing. Manufacturers, especially of these big components that we're talking about, big turbines, big wind blades, you know, you're not going to build a manufacturing plant and keep those things on your factory floor if you're not sure that there's going to be a market for them here in the United States. You're going to build it nearer to where the market is.
Yeah, I get that. But, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we've got Gamesa, one of the big turbine manufacturer.
Spanish company.
Spanish company, but there's still jobs here. I would prefer them to be American companies, but, you know, they're still building it here. Why aren't, with 9.1% unemployment, 14 million people unemployed, why aren't we using the tax dollars that went into that project to hire people right here at home?
No, it's a fair question. You know, about 50% of the components in our installed wind turbines are from the United States. It's a decent number. It's not a huge number. It's bigger than in the solar industry, for instance. But it's a fair question, and a lot of people have looked at the Recovery Act and said, how come we didn't have a kind of a Make It in America component to that? I think at the time that would have been a difficult bet because we just weren't sure how many companies were going to be making this stuff here. And now it's easier. Now there are more companies on the ground doing it. But those companies are, frankly, in trouble with the Recovery Act dollars drying up and with the production tax credit, which is the tax credit they get for development of those wind farms. With that really on the table as something that might get cut next year in the budget negotiations, a lot of those companies are now saying they might have to close up shop. So it's a very insecure market for those companies right now. It's really unclear whether a lot of the ones that are here now are going to be able to stay here.
Right. I mean, we have a demand problem, obviously. And, you know, my solution to that has always been, why doesn't the federal government, the person that uses the most energy in the world, why don't they buy the things that they need to kind of move over to alternative energy and say, you know what, we're going to buy a million solar panels or 10 million or whatever the number is, and the entrepreneurs and the global capitalists, they're going to build plants and fill that demand.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, we'd love to see much stronger procurement policies from the federal government. We're seeing some of that from the Department of Defense, but I'd love to see it across the government. You know, the administration needs to make the statement.
So when we're looking at the conversation that's going to be going forward, which is basically the Republicans telling us it's a dead issue, the solar's dead, we're going back to, you know, coal and oil, and what should we be telling people? Because this is an industry that I think is it's important, and I think it's going to create the next generation of jobs, but it's just at the beginning, and if we kill it now, my fear is, you know, we won't have this conversation again for a while. And I know, as you said, businesses are looking at alternatives, but also on the residential side of things.
No, you're right. We need to have this conversation now. I think we need to tell people on the solar stuff in particular, you know, we're making solar stuff now, and we have a trade surplus with solar. We're actually exporting solar components to China. So this is an area in which it's a bright spot in our economy. We have jobs now. There are people installing these turbines or these panels, excuse me, and we're exporting to China right now. So why would we want to kill off part of an industry sector that's creating jobs, where we're exporting, where we're competitive with other countries? You know, the clean energy industries as a whole are growing twice at the rate of the rest of the economy and have been during the recession. So why would we want to kill this bright spot in our economy that's creating real jobs? And when people say to me, well, it's not that many jobs, you know, it's only 3 million jobs out of all the jobs in America, I always say, well, you know, that's 3 million jobs that I bet the 14 million unemployed people in America would like to have.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're real jobs.
Well, how many, I mean, the jobs report's coming out Friday, and they're, what I've heard, maybe 60,000 created, and they'll be happy with that. You're talking 3 million, they're talking 60,000.
Well, the Brookings Institute came out with a report fairly recently that shows that in the clean energy, the clean economy writ large, so that includes clean transportation, waste management, conservation, all clean transit, all that stuff, there's about 2.7 million jobs. If you look at just clean energy industries, it's fewer jobs, but there's a lot of growth. The report that came out from the Department of Labor is a report about the job training programs that were funded by the Recovery Act and how many people they were able to train. And that's a different story. I mean, those programs were really focused primarily on low-income folks and getting them onto pathways into some of these jobs. And so that's all going to be a lower number because it's more about the number of people trained than the existing jobs.
What do you say to the people who are really going after the loan programs, saying, well, you promised all these jobs and they're not there? And I guess the Inspector General had something to say recently.
Yeah, well, and that's the Department of Labor report. I'm sorry, I may have an echo. Apologies if I do. The Department of Labor came out with a report, or the Inspector General came out with a report looking at the Department of Labor, showing that the green jobs training programs had not created the number of jobs they were expected to. Now, that's a little unfair. I mean, you look at a job training program in the middle of a giant recession.
Right.
And it's a little unfair to say, you know, oh, in 2007, when you created the Green Jobs Act, you said there'll be a whole bunch of jobs. But now that we're in a recession, we are not seeing all those jobs. That's true. You know, there's 5 people for every single one job that opens in America right now. There are a ton of people who need jobs. There are not a lot of jobs. So it's a little unfair to judge the training programs by the number of placements they've had. There's other problems with that report. The report doesn't take into account, for instance, the number of training programs that were for incumbent worker training or for people already, you know, already employed. That was a big chunk, about 30% of the money. So there's a lot of problems with the report. I think it's unfortunately going to get spun like everything else in a really negative way. But what it says to me is, look, we trained a bunch of people. We got some of them jobs. And I think that's a good story in this recession.
Sure. And when things turn around, we'll get those other people who are now trained and are certified and have this skill. We'll get them back to work because they're very, you know, I just had solar panels put on my house over the summer. And, you know, we had had this conversation because the people who installed them, they're worried. Their business is based on people being able to afford them and put them on their house. And I'll tell you, every month since I've had them put up, we've saved 40% on our electric bill, which is fantastic. And, you know, I think everybody should be looking at.
Yep. Yep. And you're right that if we had that kind of, you know, scale of people putting them up all over the country, then we would have, you know, essentially permanent employment for all those people who were just trained. You know, I think it's important that they were trained at all. I mean, we underspend on job training in this country in general.
Absolutely.
One thing about the training for green jobs is it tends to be training in pretty technical skills. And you're getting people, a lot of them low-income folks, to be technically literate and to be sort of at a level of math and science literacy that I think is important in general. So I think those training programs are really positive regardless of what the numbers are and how many placements they had.
I absolutely agree. And what we need now is the demand. Get these people back to work. Kate Gordon, I appreciate your time. Always great talking with you. Love to have you back again real soon. I know it's late for you, but I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick. Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Kate Gordon, Vice President of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. We're right back after this. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Listening at last to his inner FDR, President Obama is going straight at the know-nothing, do-nothing Republican Congress. At a recent rally on a bridge connecting Representative John Boehner's state of Ohio to Senator Mitch McConnell's state of Kentucky, Obama challenged the two GOP leaders to back his plan for repairing and improving our country's deteriorating infrastructure. "Help us rebuild this bridge," he shouted out to Boehner and McConnell. "Help us rebuild America. Help us put this country back to work." Yes, let's do it. However, in addition to the usual recalcitrance of reactionary Republican leaders, another impediment stands in the way of success. Many of the infrastructure jobs that would be created could end up in China. Holy Uncle Sam! How is this possible? It's due to a trap door that was built into the 1933 Buy American Act. This law gives preference to U.S. companies bidding on major infrastructure projects, except it allows the general contractor to opt out of this requirement if the difference in U.S. and foreign bids is significant. This is no theoretical concern, for it's already happening. For example, the $7 billion reconstruction of the Bay Bridge between San Francisco and Oakland is in the hands of a state-subsidized Chinese company that made the lowest bid. While there are Americans involved in this huge project, the design, engineering, prefab, supervision, and other work, as well as profits, are going to China. Consequently, California's hard-hit people and depressed economy are deprived of the wages, taxes, and consumer spending they would have gotten from some 3,000 jobs that went overseas. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, let's approve Obama's infrastructure proposal, but let's improve it by nailing the opt-out trapdoor shut. For information, go to AmericanManufacturing.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So the money's been rolling in. Evidently, Mitt Romney, who raised $2.3 million from the financial sector, Evidently, he's no big fan of the Occupy Wall Street. In fact, he says he thinks it's dangerous, this class warfare. This from a guy who took $2.3 million so far from the financial sector, from Wall Street. He thinks this whole class warfare thing, it's dangerous. He didn't seem to mind it when they were kicking our behinds. Didn't seem to mind it when they were stealing away from us. No, didn't mind that. But now that someone's actually saying, hey, wait a second, we're tired of it, now he thinks it's dangerous. Yes, for him, yeah, it's dangerous. And for his ilk, absolutely. Because you know what? They're not going to be able to control 40% of the nation's wealth, man. 40%, Jake. You want to talk about full coffers? 40%, the top 40% of the wealth, the top 1% of the people in this country.
And unless something's done, there's a good chance that that will get even worse over time. Again, for the 100th time, that's why 2012 is so critical.
It just blows my mind. When I looked at the stock numbers, the people who own stocks and bonds, at the top 1% owns more than half of all stocks, bonds, mutual funds, all of that. 1% of the people, more than half. And yet the bottom 80%, which is the vast majority of the country, holds 0.5%.
Well, I'll tell you what might be happening, and I see this more and more. We just looked at a film here of what's happening in New York. And first of all, I understand that the mayor's not too pleased with the cost. He's getting a little annoyed. Well, you better get used to it. But the point I'm trying to make is I think the younger people are starting to get involved, and they realize that, look, unless I change what's happening in this country, unless I change the fact that the banks have just run roughshod over the working class, unless I change the fact that we have inequities in our tax system, my future is bleak. And I see more and more young people coming out of here. And by the way, when I left home, the last update I heard in New York, the unions tonight were coming out in force. So that's good to hear. But I do believe this is the tip of the iceberg. I really, truly do.
Well, I mean, you look at this generation, and you got to – I've been wondering when people are going to get angry and take to the streets. And we were just talking about this last week, about, you know, the rise of the anti-war movement during Vietnam and when it really sparked. And, you know, back then it was the draft lottery. When no longer could you get deferments, your name, your ball was in the, your number was in the hopper, and it could be called at any. That's when people go, uh-oh, that could be me.
Well, you know, we just witnessed some violence here, you know, during our break. You were too young, but I remember in the 1968 Democratic Convention where there was a massive, massive police riot, and it was ugly, and young people, some of them were knocked unconscious, they were bloodied. It showed an ugly side to America, but you know what? That helped considerably to turn the tide of the public opinion in war. Maybe that's what need. I mean, there needs
that's
to
what's
be.
Happened here.
I'm not advocating violence, but that's, you know, if it happens, maybe that's what needs to occur. Maybe people need to go to the street, and if it means physically fighting for your rights, that's what you do. There's going to have to be a price paid somewhere.
Well, I hope
we're up for it.
I'm not going to the physically fighting. And, you know, look, if the cops are going to beat you up, the cops are going to beat you up. It's that nonviolence that's going to, you know, like you've seen here, you know, the police. In fact, the cop that they got pepper spraying people was also someone who crossed the line not too long ago during another protest. You've got these characters out there. And what's happened here is you saw, you know, I remember seeing the first video of a cop just grabbing this kid and throwing him like 10 feet. Cross the pavement, dragging one kid by his feet, scraping his face against the pavement. That's what sparked, I think, this interest right now. Before, it was just, you know, there was a little thing going on. But not the police, they really caused this.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, you came from a big city, Rick, and the reality is that many times, you know, when it's one-on-one, at night, nobody's around. The cops do that, but you're not going to get away with it when there's 50 cameras there. And I want to be clear what I'm talking about. I am no way advocating violence. What I'm saying is, when I say, are we willing to pay the price? I'm saying, are we willing to put in the time? Are we willing to go to these demonstrations? Are we willing to do whatever we can? Every American in some way can get involved, and we need to.
And the other question
on a
is,
massive scale.
Are you willing to get your melon cracked open by one of these swing happy cops? That's the big question as well. Anyway, Mark Ruffalo, the actor, was on with Keith Olbermann, and he said, you know, we happen to live in a time where we can have leaderless revolutions. And, you know, I kind of looked at what happened tonight here in Harrisburg at the Occupy Harrisburg thing. There was no real leader per se. There was someone who's kind of facilitating things. But everybody had their moment, I think. And I think that's what's important about this, that everyone's going to be able to have a say. You may not get the reaction you want, and people may not go along with it, but you're going to have the ability to speak your mind. And I think that's something that's been missing for a lot of folks. I think a lot of people feel marginalized by the political process. And this may be, I'm hoping that down the road this is what happens. But we're at the very beginning of this. So it's going to be really interesting. And I like what Russ Feingold said. He said that, this is like the Tea Party, only it's real. And by the time it's over, it will make the Tea Party look like, well, a Tea Party. Kind of like what I've been saying all along. It's just, there's like little kids sitting around the table having their little Tea Party. But you know, the right wing, the Tea Party people, they're not going to go down without a fight. And I'm on the email list of a couple of these radical Tea Party groups, one down in Philadelphia. And you got to love the mentality. They're a very pro-corporate, pro-business mentality there at the Independence Hall Tea Party. Their main concern is, we believe in free markets, and free markets are our guiding principle, and we see this as anti-capitalism. Really, Terry, nitwit. Here, a woman who, and her husband, whose claim to fame, really, the claim to fame here for these two is that the husband must have smarted off to a bunch of union members, and someone smacked him. He wasn't smart enough to keep his mouth shut in a crowd full of people who he was screaming at, evidently, the way the story was told to me. And someone popped him. Someone made a citizen out of him. And he went and sued and got a whole bunch of money out of it. But at the end of the day, that's what he's famous for. And now he's saying, well, you know, we it's the Obama administration. We should be focusing on the biggest corporate corruption scheme, that of the U.S. government. Well, let me let you in a little secret. The U.S. government is not a corporation. It's something that we, as people, and look, there's some things that I got problems with. And that's why you get involved, and that's why you pursue this. But the government does for us. A corporation does for itself. There's a whole different ballgame. And they also do for profit. And I've heard a couple of people say, well, how can we get the Tea Party people involved with the Occupy Wall Street? I'm like, why would you want them? Why do you want these free market people who are going to defend Wall Street? Now, you may get some of the Tea Party people like me early on who believed it could have turned into something positive. You may get those. But those aren't Tea Party people anymore. They fell off a year ago. They fell off that tea train a long time ago. The reality is you're never going to change the tea cult members. Never. You know, the ones who are still attending meetings, you're never, never going to change them. People like this Terry Anderson and her husband, you're never going to change them. They have a vested interest in being the vice president or vice president of this little tea twizzler group or that. So you're not going to change them. Leave them. My hope is that we just leave them behind and move forward in a positive way. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Josh Edelson, a former union organizer and contributor over at American Prospect and Alternate, going to be talking about what's going on in New York if he's not in jail. We're back after this.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/light.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Pull out the good old union has come in here to clear. Which side are you on?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. So during the break, I'm watching some videos that people have uploaded from Wall Street. And you look at some of these cops, boy, what are you thinking? There are 100 cameras around watching you swing that club like it's a baseball bat, cracking people. For what? It's just not going to do yourself any good. But today, labor came out to join the folks on Wall Street, and here to talk about that is Josh Edelson. He's a former union organizer and contributor to the American Prospect and Alternet. We've got links at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com to some of his work. Josh, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick.
You know, tell me what happened today. What was the atmosphere today?
Oh, it was beautiful. It was huge. Folks were angry, but folks were also really joyful. Lots of folks who haven't been out there before, who got involved through their union or through the press coverage, who were just thrilled to look around and be part of something big and powerful that can take the city, take the imagination, and take the space of New York.
So a lot of labor groups, progressive groups came out today. How many people would you say were there?
You know, I'm not a professional counter, but it was definitely in the several thousand.
So who was out today?
So on labor, I mean, groups that endorsed this march, the United Federation of Teachers, which is the AFT and NEA affiliate for New York, SEIU 1199 and 32BJ, the Transport Workers Union, who was out there, several AFSCME folks, and I'm sure a number of other locals and individuals who are out there in part because of their union affiliation, as well as a number of left and progressive groups, some of which, like the Working Families Party, have very strong labor ties, and were also part of organizing the march.
You know, this evening we went to the Occupy Harrisburg meeting to start, you know, kind of trying to, you know, catch on to what you guys are doing there in New York. And I'm taken by the diversity, the different backgrounds of all the people there, labor, progressive groups, you name it. There were folks from all 60s radicals, if you will. Just the diversity really struck me. Is it the same
Absolutely.
In New York?
Absolutely. I mean, I talked to 80-year-olds who said, this reminds me of the 60s. This is what I've been waiting for. There were young folks who were there, students who came down from out of town, people, doctors who came out because they're sick of the health insurance problems they see their patients having, teachers who came out because none of their students can find jobs. It was just a very powerful, new, but really connected community that emerged just by marching in that space together.
And what I was struck by this evening where we were, and I'm guessing it's the same in New York, is the amount of anger and the frustration that came out in people's stories, but also the fact that most of them said this is the first time that they've been able to speak their mind where they felt somebody was listening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things you see as a union organizer is In order to move, people have got to be agitated. They've got to get angry. And a lot of left-of-center politicians and a lot of the conversation left-of-center in this country has not been about people's anger and hasn't respected people's anger. And Harvey Milk was right when he said you got to give them hope, but he also talked all the time about I'm angry and I know you're angry. And it's very powerful for people to get a space to be angry and to direct it into a call for controlling and taxing and pushing back the actual elite rather than a fight between workers who have pensions and workers who don't.
Are you surprised by the police reaction in New York? I kind of am. Maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm kind of surprised.
I think it's sad, and I think we should be careful not to paint with a broad brush, and there are situations where there are limits on people's control over their role, but absolutely, there's a lot of stuff going on that absolutely should not, and it's unfortunate, and I think it's noteworthy the ease with which this kind of violence gets perpetrated against protesters on the left, where if it happened to Tea Partiers, it would get much more national attention.
Well, I think, as my one Tea Party friend said, if that were to happen to us, we would have probably shot him.
Well, I'm glad that didn't happen, but it's noteworthy that that's not a situation that we've seen.
I mean, because if you remember some of the Tea Party protests, they were actually walking around with rifles and,
right.
And being armed, and nobody seemed to have a problem with that. But boy, I think you're right. If there were some people down there today carrying guns over their shoulders, they'd be wrestled to the ground and taken away.
Oh, and I think Fox News would even break out of their Sarah Palin coverage to talk about it.
So let me ask you, maybe it is unfair of me to say that the police are being unduly violent. Is it as bad as the media is making it, or is this a construct?
So I didn't witness some of the confrontations that went on tonight. It is clear that there is terrible police violence that's going on, that, macing and beating people who are already physically restrained. There's no excuse for that. It's a violation of people's rights, and it should stop. Now, how many times it's happened, where it happened, I wouldn't speculate about, but it's clearly become part of the reality and part of the story of this protest. And nobody, when they exercise that First Amendment right to assemble, nobody should have to risk physical violence like that.
Some of the things that I've been seeing coming out of the Occupy Wall Street movement, I guess they've come up with an official doctrine of beliefs and demands. Is that true?
Yeah, there was a statement that was released from the General Assembly on Thursday, which is like the Declaration of Independence, quite a bill of indictment against corporations for all the ways that they're taking advantage of everybody else.
So when I turn on my Fox News or I turn on the mainstream corporate-controlled media and I see people like Donald Trump saying, I have no idea why they're out there, I guess now we now know, right?
Right. I mean, it's always something. They've got to be attacked for something, right? They're going to be attacked for... The weirdest one I heard is now pundits saying, oh, well, a lot of financial companies aren't on Wall Street. They're in Midtown, and the protesters are stupid, when obviously if they weren't on Wall Street, they'd be attacked for not being on Wall Street. It's always something. Either you're too broad or you're too narrow. I saw that as a student activist. The university would attack the union half the time by saying their agenda was too narrow, and half the time by saying their agenda was too broad.
So basically, you can't win for trying. And I guess that's the point. That's the point.
I think it's a worthwhile document, the one that came out on Thursday, because it does lay out not specific policies, not a specific plan for how to get there, but a strong indictment about the way that our democracy is really limited by the control that elites have over all the different parts of the system.
I personally, in looking over their beliefs and the list of demands, there's nothing on this list that I don't agree with. And I think that's a good place to start, where you have broad consensus. Reinstate Glass-Steagall, to me, something I've been calling for since the crash. Lock up the criminals who did this. Re-regulate the things that are going on and hold those accountable for doing what they did. Seems reasonable to me.
Right.
So
absolutely.
So as we move down the road, what's planned for tomorrow and beyond?
It's a good question, because escalation is part of what has captured the public imagination around Occupy Wall Street. It's part of what made so many people excited to stream in today for the first time. I mean, I remember when a few hundred people showed up the first day in New York. It's striking that in Philly, Tuesday night, they had over 1,000 people just for a planning meeting. In what, we got to admit, Philly is a smaller city than New York.
Right.
So clearly, one way we see the escalation is as these protests move to other cities in larger numbers and escalate faster than they have in New York. In terms of what happens next in New York, there have been some tough acts to follow, but maintaining a sense of momentum is going to be important to continuing to draw more people in.
Yeah, we talked with Chris Bowers from Daily Kos last night, and he said that, you know, when we had talked to him, there were over 200 groups across the country talking about, you know, establishing an Occupy, you know, Seattle Occupy, you know, wherever, and the number were growing every time he went back. So you're seeing more groups springing up and more people becoming involved, and I think that's fantastic.
Absolutely. And it's been striking in the reporting I've been doing, talking to some of the groups that organized the march today, there is a real excitement and relief from folks who feel like this is an agenda that's like the one we've been pushing, but we haven't been able to get attention. We haven't been able to capture people's imagination. And now there is this sense of momentum, and momentum is big in organizing, and momentum is big in politics.
Absolutely, and what I've been calling for for the longest time is this type of spark that gets people off their couches, out of their house, and actually talking to people. And this is, I think, an excellent opportunity to educate, activate, and engage the voting populace. So maybe some of the stuff on this list, we can maybe begin to turn around.
Absolutely. I mean, the people who I talked to today were so happy to be there. And many of them, folks who said things like, I came down from Connecticut because the media coverage sucks and I wanted to come out and see it and support it myself. Or said, you know, I saw on TV that this was happening and they're still out there. Who said, I saw the way that people continued in the face of police violence, in the face of being mocked on CNN, and that made me want to continue. I mean, most people, don't stand up just to say that they did. Most people want to see that there's a chance to win and that there's a chance to move forward. And that's something that a lot of the people who I talked to today feel about this in a way that they haven't felt in a long time.
And that's excellent. Let me ask you, you know, why are you there? I mean, are you there as a reporter? Are you there as an activist? Are you there as just a citizen?
So I'm there as a reporter. I've been reporting on particularly the role of labor and progressive groups in linking up or engaging with these folks. And, you know, I have the privilege to write for places where I can report and I can share my views about what's happening and what should be happening. But it was absolutely inspiring to be out there.
What story catches your mind?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see the relationship between labor and left groups and Occupy Wall Street around questions of procedure, around electoral questions. Some of the folks from, whether it's the Working Families Party or Citizen Action, were very clear about saying, we hope that the momentum from these actions influences legislation and influences elections. And I think there's a good reason to hope for that. If the Tea Party had decided not to influence elections, they wouldn't have been able to drag the country as far.
Yep.
Now, a bunch of folks involved, for understandable reasons, in Occupy Wall Street are going to be very skeptical of an electoral angle or perhaps even a legislation angle. And so it'll be interesting to see if those tensions develop and what happens to them. But they weren't present in the conversations I was having today. Talking to the Occupy Wall Street folks, they were just thrilled, everyone I talked to, that labor had their back.
And that's what it's going to take, and it's going to take folks coming together. I think this is an excellent opportunity to activate, educate, and engage folks, and I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes tomorrow when we're in Philly for the Occupy Philly. Josh Edelson, I appreciate your time. We'd love to have you back as this progresses.
I'd love it, Rick. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Who can time for war? Who can time for war? Truths are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Service. Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We are AFSCME.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Choke with you someone to turn around. Herman Cain, he's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane. Herman Cain, get on board, get on board the Herman Cain train.
Yeah! Get on the Herman Cain train. You gotta love Herman Cain, especially when he says stuff like this.
Don't blame Wall Street. Don't blame the big banks. If you don't have a job and you are not rich, blame yourself.
Blame yourself. Absolutely, just blame yourself. That's all it's about. That's all you can do, you know. Because hey, it's your fault. You know. Now this is the guy who won the Horatio Alger Award some years back. Saying, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Yet, here again, you know, you look at the course of his life, a lot of opportunity, given to him. But, you know, it's your fault, you know? And I love his take on the Occupy Wall Street.
These demonstrations are planned and orchestrated to distract from the failed policies of the Obama administration.
Yeah, and your 999 plan would just, make life so much better. If we could just do the 999 thing. 9% income tax, flat income tax, 9% corporate income tax, and, you know, implement that 9% sales tax, life would be so much better. And the folks over at the Center for American Progress, they actually went through and did some of the numbers. They decided, well, you know, let's put this to the test. And as I've been saying, without sitting down and crunching the numbers as they've done, it would put us in massive debt, and it would really pigeonhole us. So what they did is they went for the income tax portion of it, using the numbers that they have. It would, this 9% tax would have yielded about $665 billion in income tax revenue. The corporate tax part of it would have yielded about $112 billion in revenue, and the sales tax would have brought in about $500 billion. The only problem is it's only 9.2% of the GDP, which you got to understand we collected 18.5% of GDP in 2007. So to make this pretty simple. The Herman Cain plan would cut our revenue in half. So you would see massive, major deficits or the complete destruction of what the government does. Now, that wouldn't just be the public sector workers. That just wouldn't be, picking up your trash, or that would be goodbye to the military. That would be goodbye to an awful lot of stuff. And, you know, again, you got to love the man's ideas. If you can't find a job, you're on your own. It's your fault. You're the one who did it. Blame yourself.
Don't blame Wall Street. Don't blame the big banks. If you don't have a job and you are not rich, blame yourself.
He went down talking about, this is, 2008 was 2008. The banks aren't doing anything now. You're right. They're not doing anything now. They're killing us. But you got to love Herman. Got to love him. In fact, he's a little bit up in the polls since everyone else seems to be taking a little tick back. I'm quite frankly amazed that he's done as well as he's done, because he's right. He does have a sense of humor, and he is kind of comical to watch. So we'll keep him around for a little longer. I think it's funny. And they need to make this a horse race. That's how they're going to sell newspapers. I don't know if you saw this. Louise Slaughter, Democratic representative from New York, she was on Keith Olbermann with Tuesday, and she said that they need to have a retroactive recusal. And that's an interesting way of looking at this, of Justice Clarence Thomas. Now, they're looking at both Scalia and Thomas, saying, look, you should have recused yourself from Citizens United. And they should have, this case should have never gone the way it does. And they're looking at, going after Thomas, because they're saying that his wife made a boatload of money off of people pushing for this Citizens United. I can't disagree with it. There's a problem when you have the justices sitting on our Supreme Court who are supposed to be, they're supposed to be blind, aren't they? Justice is supposed to be blind. They're not supposed to be political. These decisions aren't supposed to sway the way of the politic. Yet, what are we seeing? We're seeing a very, very political court and a very biased court at that. And who are they biased towards? Well, the big corporations. You look at the numbers that have come out. I think it was almost three quarters of all of the business cases that have gone before the Supreme Court have ended up siding with the business interest. You and I, we don't seem to have much of a chance. And I'm kind of wondering how this healthcare thing is going to work itself out. They're going to take it this fall, and we'll see where it goes. And, I look at what, I forgot what his name is. I forget the Supreme Court justice that just retired. He said, it's clearly constitutional, but that's when he was sitting on the bench. Now that Anthony Kennedy's the number one guy, the most powerful person in the country, you kind of got to wonder. You got to wonder where this is going to go. And I'm concerned, because if you take away the individual mandate from the healthcare law, what then happens? Does the entire thing crumble down? Do we then start over again? Are we back at square one? I'm kind of worried about that. And the other part of it is, do we really need a for-profit insurance industry? Maybe starting over from scratch wouldn't be a bad idea. But 2012 being around the corner, a lot of bad things could happen, and we could end up with, you're basically on your own. We could end up like they have in Maine. They have a barter system up in Maine where the doctor will let you do yard work around their house so that they'll see you. Or you could paint their garage. Or I guess it's a good gig. You get people to do all of your housework and all of your yard work, and you see them once in a while in your office. That seems fairly all right. I don't know if you saw Sherrod Brown pushing the currency oversight bill. Now the fighting has begun. The Chinese have come out and said, this could start a trade war. We're going to start a trade war. And their folks are going, it might happen and it could hurt us. And, all of these different scenarios. And I was looking at one of this Peterson Institute came out, and one of their experts said a 20% rise in the value of the yuan would reduce U.S. current account deficits by anywhere between 50 and $100 billion. Now, remember, to this point this year so far, we're in the $200 billion range. Last year it was $237 billion trade deficit we had with China. So you're looking at a $50 to $100 billion change could help our not only our economy, but the trade deficit. They're saying a more extreme move, say 40%, would translate into as much as $200 billion in reduction. So we could almost have a balanced trade if their currency was where it should be. Now, why is this important? They're saying for every $1 billion in the improvement of the trade balance, where, you know, where we had a deficit, we now have a surplus, for every $1 billion improvement in that, that's going to create 6,000 jobs. So you're looking at $100 billion. $100 billion. You're talking 600,000 jobs. And as I heard earlier, you know, Friday the jobs numbers are supposed to come out. And we're hoping it'll show 60,000 jobs. We're hoping it'll show just an increase of that much. What would 600,000 do? To me, that's just a start. Once you get those people back to work and they start paying taxes and they start buying products and goods and services, maybe you have that jump start that needs to happen. And we get folks back to work. Some economists are even saying, you know what? If we force the Chinese to, you know, to strengthen their yuan, it could actually help China by holding down some of their inflationary problems. And that's an interesting way of looking at it. Other economists are saying, well, it's not really going to matter because we would just, you know, shift manufacturing, you know, to other low-cost producing countries like Bangladesh or Vietnam, and that the U.S. wouldn't benefit anyway. And again, for me, it comes back to, you know, we should be talking about trade with those countries as well. Not in a way of, hey, you know, our markets are open, but hey, how can we balance this out to where we both benefit and where everybody wins in this system? Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break right back after this with our good friend Mark Price from the Keystone Research Center. You know, what's going on in Greece? Could it happen here? How's Greece different? How are we different? A little conversation around that. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Inspired by both the Arab Spring and the Madison, Wisconsin worker uprising, progressive activists in 100 or more cities coast to coast are occupying city squares and plazas to protest corporate domination. The Occupy Wall Street action continues to grow in the wake of hundreds of arrests for civil disobedience. On Thursday, the Occupy movement comes to the nation's capital. These uprisings are an effort to bring real democracy to America and end corporate control of our economy, political system, and public policies. Maria Allwine is a Baltimore activist working on the Occupy DC action that begins Thursday in Freedom Plaza there.
You see the assault on labor. We're back in the 20s and the 30s when labor was trying to get a foothold. People are so angry and they finally get that we have to wrest control back to ourselves. We're going to have people's assemblies every day, the general assemblies at night. We have civil resistance actions. We have all kinds of things planned.
While the Occupy movement protesters have many issues, there is a single overarching focus common to everyone joining this movement.
The overarching issue is the role that corporations play in determining our lives. They have a stranglehold on government, no longer serves us, serves the corporate interest, and we are determined that that is not the kind of country that we're going to live in.
On Tuesday, the Occupy Wall Street movement received one of its largest endorsements when the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees pledged to stand in solidarity. Jesse Russell has more on that.
President Gerald McEntee and Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders compared what's happening on Wall Street to the winter protests in Madison, Wisconsin. They said the message to Wall Street is clear. Priority number one should be rebuilding Main Street, not fueling the power of corporate CEOs and their marionette politicians. That endorsement came on the same day as the 700,000 member strong Communication Workers of America expressing their support. The message from the CWA comes at a time when Verizon workers could soon find themselves back on the strike lines. Also levying support on Tuesday was the Amalgamated Transit Union. They've promised support both physically in the protests, but also by providing food and other supplies.
The UAW and Ford Motor have reached a tentative deal on a new four-year contract. The union says it means 12,000 jobs created or retained as Ford invests $16 billion in the North American auto industry. More details will be released as the UAW's 41,000 Ford members vote on the proposed new contract. On Tuesday, working people took a message to politicians on Capitol Hill. Pass President Obama's American Jobs Act and don't pass more global trade deals that kill U.S. jobs. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard and International Association of Machinists President Tom Buffenbarger were among those pushing Congress to act on jobs and to reject pending trade deals they say won't create jobs or help working people. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. So as I talked about earlier, in Greece, you saw 20,000 people out in the streets because the austerity programs there are really, really hitting the lower working class extremely hard and the entire working class. Are those policies something that we may see here at some point? That's why I've asked labor economist Mark Price from the Keystone Research Center to come talk to us. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick. It's great to be here.
You know, I look at these protests in Greece, and I look at the protests in New York, and you're led to one conclusion. People are angry. They're upset. Are they similar?
No. I mean, certainly the anger in the streets is certainly very similar. I think, you know, the Greek situation is probably a bit more sensitive for the Greeks, at least. You know, one of the things they've been having going on there is that, you know, back in May of 2010, the IMF came in, the International Monetary Fund, and basically the IMF gets a lot of its marching orders from the U.S. government. You know, we have a very good relationship. We share a lot of professionals among the organizations, and they came up with an austerity package, basically telling the Greeks they had to cut a variety of social programs, cut public sector employment, cut wages. Those austerity, at that time when those things were implemented, GDP, the amount of debt they had relative to GDP, which is the typical measurement of, you know, how bad your debt situation is, it was around 115% at the time. Today, we're projecting next year that ratio will have risen to 189%.
Wow.
So the, you know, the IMF comes in, tells you to do something, which is basically austerity, shrink your economy, and in fact, that's what's happened. They've actually now in a situation where the growth rate, well, we think of it as a growth rate, but actually their economy is, they thought it was going to shrink by 3%. It's now looking like it's going to shrink by about 6%. And the real madness here, though, Rick, is that when this happens, when the economy shrinks, that means the Greek government's bringing in even less revenue. So they're once again thrown back into the situation that they've got a budget deficit, which they've got to reduce. So they've got to go through another round of austerity measures. And in fact, this whole recent spark of concern across the world is because the IMF started having an argument with the Greek government over $8 billion of funding, telling the Greeks they weren't cutting enough. So I think, you know, I think we can sort of understand, you know, the anger in the streets of Greece, because basically they've been doing what they've been told to do, and the situation's actually getting worse. And as you said, the conditions really are hitting those folks, regular folks more than they are anybody else, certainly more than the banks.
Yeah, anytime you bring up the IMF, I think of, you know, Latin America and the, all of the things, basically the same circular events that happened, as you've laid out here in Greece, happened in Latin America for years now. And I've yet to find anything where the IMF gets involved, where it actually makes things, well, things better.
No. They come in and they pitch an austerity package, which is just brutal. And it leads to a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. And they're at it again. And, you know, and actually, they're sort of sparking a lot of uncertainty now for the Italians. The Italians are beginning a similar phase to what the Greeks have been going through. The Italians went through a set of budget cuts. Now the economy looks like it's not going to be growing as much. The IMF is pushing for them to engage in even more cuts, and interest rates on Italian bonds are rising. And actually, that's the other thing. The 2-year yield on a Greek treasury now is 66%.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, they do better finding a loan shark.
Yeah, good luck on that.
Yeah. Now, in contrast, the U.S. yield on a treasury is 0.26%, right? I mean, well less than 1%, practically zero, essentially. And that's, I think, another important point to drive home here. The Greek situation is very different than what we have. Their debt to GDP ratio, as I said, was, you know, somewhere around 150%. Right now, our debt to GDP ratio is about 60%. So ours is healthy, but it's not anywhere near a crisis. And we also have a lot of tools that the Greeks don't have. I mean, one of the things, the problems back in Europe is that the Greeks don't have a currency, of their own. They're part of the euro. If they had a currency, they could devalue their currency, which would improve their trade position, which would help them boost exports. It would also lower the differences that they experience between Greek wages and wages in the rest of the continent. And so it's a way of adjusting that doesn't lead to as much pain for the broader population, but it's a tool they don't have.
So,
and we have that tool here in the U.S., so, and we should be using it. You know, I'm sure you guys have been talking about the Chinese currency manipulation.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up and say, you know, it's kind of exactly what we're talking about, what we're doing with this Currency Oversight Act that Sherrod Brown has put forth, and what the Chinese are claiming we're going to do and devalue their currency or devalue ours so that, you know, we do to them what they claim we did to the Japanese.
Yeah, world politics, man.
I mean, but at the end of the day, you know, I look at this, you know, in talking about China, you know, this may be that carrot, that stick that the administration needs, to kind of get them in line. If it, let's say it doesn't pass, it may be the stick that they need.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the most important tools the government has is, you know, being able to talk straight and tell someone, you've got to stop doing this. And, you know, I think that's more than any other problem we have. We have elected officials who are very bashful about talking down the dollar, which is something that needs to stop. The value of the dollar needs to fall relative to other currencies. That'll improve our trade position, and it really it'll make for a much healthier world.
So let me ask you this, going back to the Greece thing, because, you know, I hear a lot of people saying, well, you know, we're going to end up in the same situation of Greece that they're in if we don't cut wages of state workers and lay off all those teachers and get rid of policemen and get rid of fire departments and all this stuff and cut. But as you've laid out, we're not even in near similar positions.
That's right. We are not, and we're in, you know, again, we're in a better situation in part because we're sort of, and I got to emphasize the sort of, we're sort of doing the right thing. Case in point, right now, the European Central Bank should be expanding the money supply very rapidly in an effort to bring down interest rates. They should be intervening in the Italian bond market, the Portuguese bond market, do what they can to bring down those interest rates. But they're not doing those things. Here in the U.S., our Federal Reserve is engaging in as much as it can in boosting the money supply, in trying to boost economic activity through interest rates. So we're doing the right things, unlike the Europeans, with one very painful exception, that you can't just do monetary policy. You've got to have fiscal policy, right? We're going to get another jobs report this Friday, and the consensus forecast is we're going to see around 65,000 jobs. And that's making people elated because, well, last month we had zero jobs, right?
Right.
But At 65,000 jobs a month in the U.S., that's still in a situation where the unemployment rate is actually rising, not falling.
Because we're not keeping up with the demographic changes.
Yeah, right. And so what you need is another round of fiscal policy, another round of public sector spending to help boost the economy and push us closer to full employment. But as you are well aware, we seem to be stuck in a situation where the elected officials, in a way that's very painful and a parallel to what's going on in Europe, elected officials are refusing to take up additional measures to sort of spur spending. That means basically we're going to remain stuck at this very high level of unemployment, which is a serious problem. But again, it's not as serious as it is for the Europeans because it looks as though they are effectively sliding back into recession.
You brought up the Fed a second ago, and all night today, you know, I had to listen to somebody scream about the Federal Reserve, how we should do away with the Federal Reserve and go back to good old-fashioned gold. And I just don't see that as a viable option. As many problems I may have with the Federal Reserve, I don't see the gold standard coming back anytime soon.
No, the gold standard's madness, Rick. we learned a very important lesson in the Great Depression, that one of the things that actually helped drive most of the world into a simultaneous recession that turned into a depression, which scarred millions of lives, was adherence to the gold standard. Basically, it's doing much what the Europeans have been engaged in, which is not expanding the money supply. That's the problem with the gold standard, is that it's a fixed standard. And when the economy weakens, you need to expand the money supply. And you can't do that under the gold standard. And in fact, there's a long history of research that demonstrates pretty clearly the gold standard's a bad idea, and it sort of takes away a tool, right? The economy is an instrument. You've got to use what you can to move it in the right direction, and sort of eliminating the Federal Reserve is like sort of taking one of the tools away. You know, and that said, we're very critical often of the Federal Reserve. Their policy in the U.S. tends to be one that leans a bit more heavily on controlling inflation than it is on boosting employment. Although, again, I think, you know, the Fed this time has done a bit better job, although there are voices out there at the regional presidents of the Fed banks, for instance, in the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, it's Charles Plosser. You know, he's putting a lot of pressure when he's on the FOMC trying to say we shouldn't be doing additional things to expand the money supply. But so far, and a majority of folks are voting to increase the money supply. So in the short run, they're continuing to do the right things, and that's an important thing to emphasize.
So no gold standard, because, you know, I go back to these people, oh, we need to go back to paradise, which is because Ron Paul said the gold standard would make our dollar, you know, $37 per piece of paper or what. So not a good idea.
No, madness.
Madness.
I mean, just complete madness. It just pretends that basically we learned nothing in the last 80 years.
Well, I would say most of us haven't. last question I've got for you, you know, and in talking about, you know, the economy being an instrument and, you know, tools that you need to get it moving, do you look at the president's jobs plan? Is this a step in the right direction? I mean, there's some parts of it that I hate, the trade agreements, the Georgia plan, but building infrastructure, not a bad idea.
Sure. You got something against workers having to work for free?
Yeah, actually, I do.
Speaking of Georgia Works, yeah. No, on the whole, it's a good first step, right? As you said, it's got some good features in it. Infrastructure spending, this is, you know, we say it all the time to the point where we bore people to death. If you're going to build something, now is the time to do it. Interest rates are as low as they're ever going to be. The cost of construction is as low as it's ever going to be. Build now. And so that's good. We like to see the extensions of unemployment insurance. We wish Georgia Works wasn't there. The trade agreements, again, are going to do nothing in the short run to boost employment and may potentially just as well reduce employment in the long run. So, yeah, it's a step in the right direction. And, you know, we're supportive of it, but we'd like to see more. And, you know, maybe we'd like to see some of the elements be tweaked a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that, you know, as you pointed out, money is cheap right now. I mean, the interest rates are really low. We should be investing heavily.
Right. I mean, investing heavily, you know, don't build bridges to nowhere, but, you know, we got lots of bridges that go plenty of places that are, you know, in not very good shape. So
I think Pennsylvania has, what, 5,600?
Right. Right. One of the leading states in terms of the number of bridges that are potentially having some serious problems.
There's so many opportunities for investment, education, right. Healthcare, the whole nine yards. Mark Price, labor economist, Keystone Research Center. I appreciate your time. Thanks for staying up late for us.
Hey, Rick. Always a pleasure.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Listening at last to his inner FDR, President Obama is going straight at the know-nothing, do-nothing Republican Congress. At a recent rally on a bridge connecting Representative John Boehner's state of Ohio to Senator Mitch McConnell's state of Kentucky, Obama challenged the two GOP leaders to back his plan for repairing and improving our country's deteriorating infrastructure. "Help us rebuild this bridge," he shouted out to Boehner and McConnell. "Help us rebuild America. Help us put this country back to work." "Yes, let's do it." However, in addition to the usual recalcitrance of reactionary Republican leaders, another impediment stands in the way of success. Many of the infrastructure jobs that would be created could end up in China. "Holy Uncle Sam! How is this possible?" It's due to a trap door that was built into the 1933 Buy American Act. This law gives preference to U.S. companies bidding on major infrastructure projects. Except, it allows the general contractor to opt out of this requirement if the difference in U.S. and foreign bids is significant. This is no theoretical concern, for it's already happening. For example, the $7 billion reconstruction of the Bay Bridge between San Francisco and Oakland is in the hands of a state-subsidized Chinese company that made the lowest bid. While there are Americans involved in this huge project, the design, engineering, prefab, supervision, and other work, as well as profits, are going to China. Consequently, California's hard-hit people and depressed economy are deprived of the wages, taxes, and consumer spending they would have gotten from some 3,000 jobs that went overseas. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, let's approve Obama's infrastructure proposal, but let's improve it by nailing the opt-out trapdoor shut. For information, go to AmericanManufacturing.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Having some mic problems again. I don't know if you saw this story. Tennessee. You know, we've been talking about voter fraud here in the state of Pennsylvania. They want to pass this voter ID bill that it's going to solve all our problems. Even though I got to be honest, I didn't know we had a problem, and no one could point to anything that shows me there was a problem. So we've got a fix for a problem that didn't exist. But in Tennessee, evidently they have passed one of these voter identification laws. Another example of the Republicans with complete control ramming through their ALEC-type agenda bills, to really disenfranchise the elderly, the poor, minorities, you name it, people who wouldn't vote for Republicans to begin with. Now we actually have a case. This woman, Dorothy Cooper, a 96-year-old Chattanooga resident who has voted in every election since she has been eligible. 96-year-old woman has voted in every election. Well, she went down because she wanted to get her voter ID because didn't want to miss out on having the opportunity to vote. So she went down with her rent receipt. She went down with a copy of her lease. She went down with her voter registration card. She went down with her birth certificate. But on the birth certificate, it had her maiden name, Dorothy Alexander. they denied her a voter ID card. And why? Well, because she didn't have her right name on the birth certificate. See, she was married twice, outlived two husbands. And she didn't have a marriage certificate because both husbands she's outlived. So here is an example of a woman who has voted in every election possible. State of Tennessee, not going to allow that to happen. She will be given a provisional ballot. She'll be able to vote, you know, maybe it counts, maybe it doesn't, who knows. But like she's saying, look, I've gone to the polls. I've been going there for years. I know everybody. We all vote here. We always come to the voting poll. And now they've taken this away from her. Now, here's the thing. She's never had a driver's license. She never learned how to drive. So why would she need this type of identification? But that the lack of that valid marriage license. Sorry, honey. Sorry, granny. You can't vote. And that's what they want to do here in Pennsylvania. That's the move, man. To, you know, keep people away. 96-year-old woman. Anyway, there is a rally, a town hall meeting for the President's Job as Act next Thursday, not tomorrow, a week from tomorrow, October 13th, 7 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore, 1302 North 3rd Street here in Harrisburg. I'm going to talk about the jobs bill. There are a number of groups coming out. Hopefully there'll be a number of people out to talk about the jobs bill. I know the next meeting of Occupy Wall Street is going to be at the same Midtown Scholar Bookstore. So lots going on there. I hope everyone comes out. We hope to see you because we're going to be at both events as they come up. I don't know if you saw this. House Democratic Whip Mike Hanna came out with a resolution today asking the governor's advisory council on privatization and innovation to sign an accountability and integrity pledge. Basically saying, look, if you're going to be on this panel, 17 of the 24 of you gave money to the governor. Maybe you should have to sign something that says you're not going to benefit from the privatization that's going to happen. Look, it's not about if we're going to privatize with these people. It's about what's going to be privatized. These folks that are on this list, and we went through it earlier in the week, these are not, oh, well, maybe we should think about it. No, these are, we're going to do it, and this is how we're going to profit from it. Like education. And I think voters here in the state get it. There was a nationwide public policy polling option here. Well, actually, it was a Terry Madonna opinion research poll done on a statewide basis. And you know what I found out? The majority of people in this state don't want vouchers. The survey showed 65% opposed or strongly opposed vouchers, 43% of those strongly opposed. 35% were in favor, but only 11% strongly in favor. But you know what? Here in Harrisburg, they're going to ram this through. They're going to go full steam ahead. They're going to do what they can do. And you look at the age difference older folks didn't want it. People with kids didn't want it. Even people whose kids were in private schools didn't want it. In fact, what I found interesting, the number of people who were in private schools, they were among the higher numbers of people who didn't want it. Adults with no children in home, 67% opposed. As where you had people who had kids in private school, 64% opposed. Now, people with kids in public school, 60% opposed. So you're seeing a lot of people going, wait a second. I don't want to profitize education. I don't want to throw a good deal down the drain and profitize it. I think it's coming. I think people are waking up to the realities that this whole scheme and this privatization scam, understand, it's not going to be just education. It's not going to just be the wine and spirits shops. It's not going to just be looking at the turnpike. It's going to be every function of our government. It's going to be everything that we do. And on the short term, it may save a penny or two. But in the long haul, we are going to lose. It has been proven time and time again. Nothing good comes of this. These people wouldn't be pushing for this so hard if there wasn't profit to be made at the other end of this. They wouldn't have invested so much money in the Corbett administration if there wasn't a payoff at the end. I mean, the gas drillers who gave him over $1 million, they're getting paid off quite well. No drilling tax. I think most people, the majority of people, if you talk to them, say, look, everybody else has a drilling tax. Why don't we? What sense does that make? And the reality is it makes no sense. None whatsoever. But we've got a governor who took the pledge, took the grand pledge. You know, Grover Norquist's no tax pledge. But there are a couple of Republicans going, hey, wait a second. You know, this is bad business. Frank Wolf, a Republican from Virginia, on Tuesday, ripped into the Grover Norquist anti-tax pledge and actually went after Grover himself, because Grover doesn't have a squeaky clean background. He was tied up in that whole Jack Abramoff deal, if you remember. Spent an awful lot of time in that. He actually lobbied for Fannie Mae, which kind of puts him in a really weird spot with the conservative movement, because they want to beat up on Fannie Mae. He's one of the people who said, oh, no, we should expand this. Lobbied for them to basically loosen the reins. He also lobbied in favor of Internet gambling. Again, you know, another one of these things that maybe you should think about a little bit. But Wolf came out and said, look, you know, it's dumb. He's profited from unsavory people. He says, simply put, I believe Mr. Norquist is connected with and has profited from a number of unsavory people and groups out of the mainstream. He said, I also believe Mr. Norquist has used the Americans for ATR, the American for Tax Reform pledge, as leverage to advance many other issues that many Americans would find inappropriate. Kind of like not taxing the drillers. And he said, when taken as a whole, it should give people pause. And I agree with him. Finally, a Republican who's going, hey, enough already. You look in Congress, the vast majority of people who've signed it, they've signed on here in the state house. You've got in the state Senate, you've got people who've signed on to this thing. And our governor has signed on to this. You know, one of the few things I give Todd Platts credits for, he didn't sign on to Grover's pledge. And I find it amazing that anyone would sign that and say, I'm absolutely never going to do anything in the future. You're just not gonna do it. It's kind of bizarre to me. But that's where we are. Lastly, there's a whole bunch of, I don't know if you've noticed this, but a lot of the Tea Party people, they're getting Tea Party challengers. Evidently, the Tea Party not happy with a lot of the folks that they put into office, and they're gonna throw them out. In fact, Alan West has found some pretty sharp criticism from the Tea Party. One of the guys who's pretty much been their conservative warrior, been one of their top guys, he may see a challenger. It's kind of weird how this has all worked out, but I think it's good, and I think it's funny and good for them. I'm looking forward to seeing them eat themselves. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Toya. I'm a sales rep, and I work for Capital Blue Cross.
If you're choosing Medicare coverage, Toya will meet you anywhere to help you decide.
I met him at food courts, diners, the parks, on a bench. And today, we're meeting at airport.
Mike was a Navy service person, an engineer, and a pilot.
I'm a senior blue BPO member.
He is technically retired.
I'm a gray-haired teenager.
Mike appreciates the visit.
It's more personal, and you can talk easier. You can show emotion, which you can't over the telephone. And it's more caring.
Toya would agree.
I love my customers. I really, really do. My main objective is to show them that I care. When you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 1-888-340-3978, Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Capital Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
Sad day in the Apple world and really, really across the world, I would have to say.
It is pretty unbelievable. Steve Jobs was not very old. The Apple site allows people, I mean, they have a big, beautiful picture of him and allows people to send in their comments and thoughts. So I'm sure he's going to get people from all over the world.
It's a sad day, but, you know, it's not surprising. I don't think anybody's really surprised.
No. I mean, you know, he'd taken all this time off and then much more recently. I mean, I'm surprised. He looked as good as he did till the very end, really.
Yeah. You know, the other part, and I was thinking this a minute ago, you know, he benefited from the best health care the world has. And, you know, he succumbed to the pancreatic cancer, if I remember right.
Right.
You know, I think about average everyday folks who don't have those opportunities. And it's something, going back to the health care debate, something we should have for every single person in this country.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My right-wing friend on Fox News, Jim Pinkerton, he may be right-wing, but he really has an idea. He said, you know, we're arguing about the fine points of Obamacare and all this, that, and the other, who likes it, who doesn't like it. But he said the real issue is that, you know, we used to spend and put our energy in this country in research, like the Salk vaccine, and our health care costs were enormous. On polio, and then we invented the health vaccine, and we need to, as a country, start not to so much worry about the fine points of Obama's plan or this, that, and the other, but to really put the money into research to make sure that these big diseases, such as cancer, et cetera, we tackle.
Absolutely, but, you know, here again, we can't figure out how to invest in fixing the pothole on the local road. How are we going to do big things? Because you look at what's going on in Washington, they can't pass a bill for appropriations to fund the government for 4 days without bickering. What you're talking about, that's a massive investment and one we do desperately need.
That is for sure, and anybody who looks around realizes that it's not the same infrastructure as we grew up with.
Yeah. You know, speaking of, you know, since Steve Jobs passed away, I guess another figure has gone on, the career of Sarah Palin. Evidently,
yes, I mean,
decided she's not running.
She's definitely not running. She talked about it on, I forget whose radio show right now. But the fact is, she then issues this basically statement and says, well, because of our, you know, my family and our, we care and, you know, God, one of those, whatever.
Yeah.
Saccharine little statement.
Do you think she ever intended on it, or was this just a tease to put some more money in her pocket?
I think she toyed with it, but I think when she came back to her senses, she realizes that she was making money and be stupid to run.
Exactly. And to get it in.
Money talks loud.
Absolutely. And to get it in at this late part of the game, she really didn't have the infrastructure. She really didn't have the fundraising base. And if you look at the money that Perry in just 7 weeks, what was it, $17, $18 million?
Right. $17 million. Now, it is true that Romney last quarter raised $18 million. But this $17 million is quite a bit from somebody who the media is saying, oh, his poll numbers are down. Well, the media is not paying attention to where people are really giving money.
Well, I mean, you know, the Wall Street folks are making sure Mitt is taken care of.
Yeah, for sure. And you're going to the rally on Friday night or what?
We're
going to
go tomorrow morning. We'll be at the Occupy Philly tomorrow. This evening we were at the Occupy Harrisburg meeting because hopefully we're going to get something off the ground here in Harrisburg. Tomorrow morning we will be in Philadelphia, you know, to cover that and, you know, participate and do all of that. And I'm really excited about this thing. I think there's an opportunity here for people to have a voice and to get that frustration out. I mean, at the meeting tonight, you heard a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, a lot of I used to be hopeless, but now this is giving me hope, and I think it's great.
Well, I think that as somebody, I was just talking to somebody at dinner, and they said, look, you know, you have all these people with college educations that can't get jobs. Of course they're going to be angry and make sure that this kind of demonstration comes off. It's not a bunch of old bats who are 60s radicals that are doing this. It's young folks.
Well, there were a handful of 60s radicals too. I got to tell you, in the room of about 250 people here in Harrisburg, probably the most diverse gathering of people I have ever been with.
Really?
I mean, it was you had the 60s radical types. You had the, you know, the young kids who you can't really decide what they're doing. And you had everybody in between. I mean, it was pretty remarkable.
Wow.
So we're going to see what
that's great.
We're going to see where this whole thing takes us. But at the end of the day, I think what has to happen is you have to find the common enemy, and I think the common enemy is going to be Wall Street. And you know, I see Harry Reid, you know, or it was DeFazio saying, you know, we need to maybe have a transfer tax, a transaction tax. Not a bad idea.
Well, it's interesting what's happening to these taxes. I mean, because, look, there needs to be some stimulus plan. I think there's no question about that. But how are you going to raise the money for it? And I think that the president originally said people earning $250,000, $300,000 a year ought to pay a little more. Well, I guess there's some Democrats that are running scared for re-election, and they said no, no, no to Harry Reid, and so now they came up with a plan for $1 million.
So anyone making over $1 million, which I guess is somewhere around 240,000 people.
I didn't see the stats. You probably did the research. 240,000 people?
Yeah, 0.17%, just under 2% of the population.
Uh-huh. Makes over $1 million a year. Wow. Okay.
And the compromise plan, you know, I guess it's as a first start. You know, because the polling numbers are there. The vast majority of Americans want over $1 million to be taxed. 250, you know, maybe a little too close to. Maybe I can do that at some point. So we'll see where this goes. I'm hopeful.
Right. I'm hopeful too. Except you have this Republican members of Congress.
Well, and the Bentney Democrats as well. So we'll see where this goes. It is what it is. I guess there's this Trans Canada pipeline. What's going on with this?
Well, it's interesting because apparently the final word on this has to come from the State Department because obviously it involves cross country lines. And several liberal Democrats, including Earl Blumenauer, have written to Hillary Clinton and said, look, the State Department has been championing this, and it's never been considering whether there shouldn't be just a no that we don't do this. Now, it's interesting because it depends who you talk to. You sort of have the environmentalists and people very concerned about water, and then you have some of the union people that actually think it's going to bring jobs, so they're in favor of it. It's a very mixed bag in terms of which constituency is in favor of it and which is not. They wrote to Hillary Clinton. They said, we want you to really consider taking a closer look at this.
Well, we'll see where that goes. Because you're right, it's a mixed bag, and I know a lot of my labor friends are in favor of it, and there are even some labor groups that are vehemently opposed to it. So it is one of those things. Lastly, Ken Salazar, the Interior Secretary, had something to say on fracking.
That's right. He is in favor of fracking. He says that it's much safer. And it should be done, and that's the only way to preserve our natural gas supplies. And so he came out pretty strongly for it today.
Well, there you go. That should make the folks here in Pennsylvania very happy. Should make our governor thrilled, especially since we're not taxing what's coming out of the ground underneath our feet. You know, I look at it and I go, we're just reliving the same bad movie over and over again.
That is for sure.
Absolutely insane. Anyway, Ellen Ratner, I appreciate the time. Always great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, and now to find out what's going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Very interesting article coming out of Politico. Two gentlemen that we talk about quite a bit, the Koch brothers, apparently not only do they invest large amounts of their own fortune, but they also make a concerted effort to collect million-dollar donations from their friends, most of whom are CEOs, well-known GOP money men and philanthropists, people like Rich DeVos, who founded Amway and who owns, incidentally, the NBA's Orlando Magic, the Marshall family, better known for oil tycoon Howard Marshall. Howard Marshall was the very, very old man. In fact, he was 89 when he married one of the more famous Playboy playmates, Anna Nicole Smith. He's also a member of the Million Dollar Club. Someone by the name of Charles Schwab, who many of you who invest, if that name sounds familiar, he's the founder and co-chair of the U.S.'s largest independent brokerage firm. And then another name from the investment portfolio that you, in fact, you might have some mutual funds with the father of this gentleman. Gentleman in question is John Jack Templeton Jr. Him and his wife have doled out $1 million, and they also run something called the Evangelical Christian Jack Templeton Foundation. His father was the man who founded the Templeton Mutual Fund Company. In fact, his father became a billionaire. Also, a man by the name of Joe Croft, the reason he's famous, he's the founder and former CEO of Cintas Corporation. If you know anything about Cintas, they are very, very virulently anti-union. And this man is a very, very wealthy corporate conservative donor. Also CEO and chair of Natural Resources Partners, which is a natural gas company. Their names are Art Pope and his wife Kathy. So as you can see, the Koch brothers not only donate an awful lot of money, but they bring in millions and millions more. And these are the people that are a direct threat to our political environment right now, and they are the major donors of all the very wealthy people. They are responsible for putting more money in the political system than anybody. Interesting article coming out of the Patriot. Yesterday there were meetings held up in the Capitol to discuss the plan by the Governor Corbett, and Senator Pileggi. Their plan is to change the way we do our presidential election. And their plan calls for the majority vote in 18 of the congressional districts. Whoever wins that majority vote, obviously their side gets the vote, and also two at large. There were some committee hearings on the Hill. Former Republican Sherman Novak testified. He actually testified for the change. Democratic State Chairman Burns testified. He obviously testified against. He made an impassioned plea for them not to adopt it. And you had several national organizations, the League of Women Voters and Common Cause, who came at it from a third angle, and they are advocating what you call the national popular vote. The irony is there were three advocates for the national popular vote, three of the spokesmen from an organization that's funded by political activist Galisano of New York, former Senator Fred Thompson, former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar, and former congressman from Colorado, Tom Campredo. The irony is they came from, I believe, Washington, and the irony is that they were not allowed to speak. You hear some talk, and I've done some reading on this subject, and some of the Republicans seem to think that if we would adopt a national popular vote, that somehow this would hurt the Republicans. And in Pennsylvania, you hear the governor and Pileggi talk about, well, you know, if the way it is now, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh decide. Well, you know, if you really look at the state of Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania is very similar to other states, the vote around the suburbs of the big cities, the vote in small towns and in rural areas tend to be Republican. So it evens out. So I'm not so sure that makes a lot of sense. I'd like to throw out some information. I was actually shocked when I read this, Rick. 1969, the U.S. House of Representatives voted for a national popular vote by a wide margin, 338-70. It was endorsed, and listen to this, it was endorsed by Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, George H.W. Bush, and Bob Dole, not liberals at all. I do believe that the Pileggi Corbett proposition will not be adopted. There is an increasing pressure from the power structure of the Republican Party, both in the state and in Washington. There's also opposition within the caucus of the congressmen that sit in Washington and represent Pennsylvania. I do not believe that their proposal will be adopted. I do believe in the end they will keep the system that we have. One other thing, Rick. We talk about SB1, the bill that would allow vouchers in our our school system. There's going to be a public debate. Maybe some of you people in Harrisburg area want to jot these figures down, these facts. On Wednesday, October 26th, at 7 p.m., the Unitarian Church in Harrisburg, that the address is 1280 Clover Lane, that's 1280 Clover Lane, Harrisburg, there's going to be a debate panel. And on that panel will be Otto Banks. He's the executive director of an organization by the name of REACH, Road to Educational Achievement Through Choice, Dr. Jill Sunday, who's a PhD at Elizabethtown College, Matt Briate from the Commonwealth Foundation, Dr. Joan Duval Flynn, NAACP, Senator Mike Farmer, a local state senator from the 48th Senatorial District, Andrew Hoover from the ACLU of Pennsylvania, Dick Comer Esquire from the Institute of Justice, and Dr. Timothy Sleekar, PhD at Penn State Altoona. So keep that date open. It'll be Wednesday, October 26th at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church of Harrisburg, 1280 Clover Lane, Harrisburg. Back to you, Rick.
All right, let's take a quick break.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Just got time to say a prayer while you wait.
welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you got any questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. If you miss any portion of our program, you can download the podcast at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. Again, next Thursday, October 13th, 7 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore, 1302 North 3rd Street in Harrisburg. They're going to have a town hall-type meeting to talk about the jobs plan the president has put forth, and the state of the economy. You'll have a number of speakers there. I think our friend Mark Price will be there speaking on behalf of the Keystone Research Center. An awful lot of work that needs to be done, and today the president announced, the White House announced that they would be doing some improvements to the electrical transmission grid, creating thousands of jobs in 12 states, of which Pennsylvania is one of them. Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, New Mexico, Nevada, Wyoming, Utah, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Wisconsin, and of course Minnesota. We're going to do some work on doing what we should have been doing years ago, fixing our grid, upgrades that'll help handle the increased amount of production needed. Look, now this is why I'm in favor of green energy. This is why I'm in favor of people putting solar panels on their houses, us moving to alternative energy, geothermal, smart, lots of things to get folks off the grid. The more homes we can get off the grid, the better off we're going to be as a nation. The less coal we're going to have to burn, the less pollution we're going to have to create. Smart policy. And, you know, this administration, while having tried, I don't know that's enough. But again, you know, it's the Republicans who have done a masterful job of blocking, have done a masterful job of gridlocking, and we are where we are. But there's opportunity. I look at Michigan. The Department of Transportation announced that they're going to give a $196 million grant to Amtrak to improve its Michigan lines. They're here again, creating thousands of jobs. In fact, they're going to reduce the transportation time between Detroit and Chicago by as much as 30 minutes. And that, you know, again, a good thing, something we should be looking into. There are plenty of opportunities to invest. There are plenty of opportunities to upgrade. Shouldn't we be thinking about it? That's why, you know, part of the president's plan I'm in favor of. Building roads, building bridges, fixing up our infrastructure, maybe looking into broadband access, a whole bunch of stuff, a whole bunch of possibilities. We just don't seem to have the political will right now. Now, my problems with the president's plan, the Georgia plan, just almost a non-starter for me. The fact that we're going to give employers free workers. Here's a bunch of free workers. They're going to work for free. Go ahead. You know where that leads? That leads to people laying folks off so they can get them back when they're on unemployment for free. That's where that goes. So lots to discuss. And again, October 13th, 7 o'clock at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore. You're going to want to be there to hear about the jobs plan and have your opinion. And I'll be there because for me, that's what it's about. That Georgia plan just makes no sense whatsoever. Now, if you were putting those folks to work cleaning up neighborhoods, you were putting those folks to work helping granny down the street, you were using it to help where nothing's being done, I'm in favor of that. But saying to a for-profit corporation, oh, here, take this trial employee, and if they work out, you can keep them, and if not, oh, just throw them aside. The Georgia plan has a 15% keep rate. To me, that's not quite high enough for this program to be even remotely viable. Anyway, I look at this. The governor's got his problems, and his budget secretary, this Charles Zogby, you gotta wonder about his wife. I mean, I feel for the guy almost because he's in a power position. He's in a position where, you know, the public is gonna watch out. Again, I guess she got herself into some trouble back at the end of September. Flipped her car, smashed into a wall, evidently hydroplaned, I guess she claimed, overcorrected.
Every time you turn around, her name is in the paper. You know, I think if I were Corbett, I might ship the both of them away. I don't know. It's one of those things where you got to just, honey, stop already, please. You're making me look bad. Anyway, so tomorrow we're going to be in Philadelphia, and this is how this is all going to work out. We're going to be in Philly today. We're going to be recording folks all day long. I don't know what to expect. I'm hoping for thousands of people to turn out. I'm hoping not to get hit in the head with a police nightstick. That's always a good place to start, not getting beat up and not getting arrested. Probably a good start. But this is exciting times, and it's going to be interesting to see where this whole thing takes us. As we start tomorrow on the journey towards occupying Philadelphia, and then here, tonight's meeting with the folks trying to set up an Occupy Harrisburg. There is an opportunity, a chance for people to have their voice heard, and that's what I took from the meeting tonight. You know, a number of folks stood up and said, look, you know, this is the first time that I feel someone's listening, that there's an opportunity to be heard. And, you know, in this digital age where you can type all you want, are people really listening? And it's going to be interesting to see how this works itself out. It's going to be interesting to see how this all comes together, or if it does. I'm excited. I think it's going to be an excellent opportunity to talk to folks and hear stories, because at the end of the day, the people that we heard tonight, angry, frustrated. And it comes back down to, you know what? Everything that we've been told. If you work hard and play by the rules, you're going to get ahead. Not happening. That 401k that they kept promising would be the road to riches hasn't happened. All of the things that, you know, my generation especially grew up thinking that if you work hard, you just do what you're supposed to do, you'll be fine. Well, what we're seeing now is we're seeing millions of people going, I can't find a job. We're seeing millions of people being thrown out of their homes. We're seeing millions of people without health care. We're seeing millions of people struggling. And I think that's what this is all about. And tomorrow we're going to bring you that. We'll be back in the studio on Monday. See you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.